to George Washington University and the Elliott School of International Affairs and to this conference on Asia in the Second Nuclear Age. My name is Mike Mochizuki. I'm Associate Dean for Academic Programs here at the Elliott School. We're doubly delighted to be able to team up with the National Bureau of Asian Research to host this timely conference. As you know, NBR is one of the great national and international assets in the study of key policy issues in Asian international affairs. NBR, over the years, has been producing a lot of cutting-edge, timely research in the form of policy reports, books, and they edit an excellent policy journal on Asian policy. And, of course, the Strategic Asia volumes is really, I think, the flagship publication of the National Bureau of Asian Research. And today we are here to roll out the 13th volume of Strategic Asia. The second reason why we're so delighted to be able to host this conference today is that the theme of this year's Strategic Asia volume parallels and overlaps some of the research that we are now pursuing here at the Elliott School. The Seeger Center for Asian Studies and the Rising Powers Initiative is now in the middle of a multi-year project on nuclear debates in Asia, and I co-direct that project with Dr. Deepa Olapoli. And also, the Institute for Security and Conflict Studies here at the Elliott School is about to embark on a multi-year project on U.S. strategic nuclear policy towards China. And that project is led by Professor Charles Glazer, who's director of the Institute for Security and Conflict Studies, and he will be chairing the first panel. And so many of us are just looking forward to learning a lot from this conference, and I should also say that we are delighted to have both the Seeger Center and the Institute for Security and Conflict Studies co-host this on behalf of the Elliott School with NBR. So welcome, and I look forward to an exciting conference. And now I'd like to turn the podium over to Dr. Richard Eldings, who is the president of NBR, and he will introduce our keynote speaker. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. I got in this regalia just because of the topic. I want people to know that. Asian studies, as you can see, for those of you who are younger students, is hazardous duty. So, anyway, very pleased to be here. This is spectacular. Mike, thank you so much. Mike contributed to a couple of editions of Strategic Asia in the past, does a magnificent job, and is just one of those public intellectuals in the Asia field that is just a treasure to our country. And Mike, thanks for all that you're doing and your leadership here at the school. School's had a tradition of leadership. Harry Harding and others, just really, really wonderful. And actually, I have to tell you that I hate to admit that I have this this age associated with me, but Gaston Seeger was a heck of an American, also Asia specialist, and NBR had the privilege of working with Gaston in some of our first programs, and those were just wonderful, and he was a spectacular contributor to those. All right, so let me get back to the prepared remarks, which I so rarely do, but I promise I will say the things I'm supposed to. Let me just say a couple of words about this volume. You know, in each year of the series, this is again our 13th, we focus on we have a theme. We want the volume to convey each year kind of a full sense of the strategic environment, but we have a really important theme, and this is a tight theme. It's a huge issue. It's one that has not been entirely overlooked, but overlooked so much in the public discussion and overlooked in some of its theoretical development and in some of the development of focusing on the results of specific interactions of both existing and latent nuclear powers in the region. So it needs, we felt, another kind of systemic look. We felt that programs in Asia had not been, in some cases, diagnosed fully. The implications of these things have not been understood fully. But particularly in the policy milieu, this has gotten lost, and it is one of the fundamental major developments in world affairs in our world today. This change in the basic structure of kind of the core, most powerful components of power, nuclear weapons, a change in the basic structure in the world from the bipolar, so-called kind of the first generation, first period of nuclear history in which the U.S. And the Soviet Union dominated other powers, England, France, and then in kind of the middle of things, China, were very much kind of lower order and not really defining the basic structure of nuclear power. This second nuclear age is different because it is fundamentally multipolar. It is not dominated by two. It is skewed multipolarity. It's uneven. It's not like everybody has the same number of weapons and so on. But the dynamics resulting from the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the delivery capabilities associated with them has fundamentally changed the dynamics and the way nations think, the incentives for proliferation, questions of deterrence, and so on. So these are fundamental issues that affect us today and especially going into the future that we felt were absolutely key to not only elucidate, but in sessions such as this and in sessions with Senator Sessions, as we had yesterday, key players in the defense establishment, in the milieu here in Washington that determines our defense policies. It's imperative that this phenomenon be better understood. So, in any case, we think it's an important thing to do. We did it. I'm very pleased to find out, Mike, that here at the school you've got programs as well. That's terrific. Now, I want to thank a few people. One is Ashley Tellis over there. I like to say, Ashley, this is your 50th or 100th year doing this. Actually, it's only his 10th. And we've been doing Strategic Asia for 13 years, first under the research directorship of Aaron Friedberg, who coined the term Strategic Asia, and now so ably, incredibly, by Ashley. And so what a spectacular job. Huge thanks. I don't know what we're going to do, pop the cork on the 10th anniversary. We're going to have to do something special. I'm not sure what it is, but we'll figure it out. So anyway, his intellectual leadership is just extraordinary and in this town in general, but for this series, obviously. We've got so many people who contribute to this volume. I was mentioning to Senator Sessions that, and to Mike, of course Mike experienced it on two occasions, this is a book, a fresh volume, a serious intellectual policy-relevant volume produced every year from scratch with mainly scholars and then I'd say scholar practitioners being the other category who contribute to it. These are not people who are used to kind of tight writing deadlines. Many of them, almost all of them, have tenure. And so we come in and say, yeah, you know, by such and such a date, and we, you know, first time they work for us, they sort of look at us and smile, and then they realize we are dead serious. we have a late September, early October release date, and it is immutable. So anyway, I want to say that the staff, that our professional staff of editors and who organize the planning meetings, these volumes are integrated. So the contributors come together and they hash things out. Ashley's not satisfied with, you know, separate chapters in a traditional scholarly effort. This is an integrated volume, so they've had a chance and throughout the whole process to talk to each other. So when this thing comes out, they've read each other's papers. Ashley's had a chance to critique, better integrate them. It's a huge process. And Ashley and the staff, Trav Tanner, has been part of this for a number of years. You'll hear from Trav today. Greg Chaffin's been doing this now a couple of years. And others. I can name our editorial staff, which is just fantastic. So, in any case, thank you all, and just to let you all appreciate what a job this is. Okay, well, last thanks, I guess, to the university, the Elliott School, the Seeger Center. I got to mention a couple of funders that are so critical to this, the Lyons and Harry Bradley Foundation, which has been a stalwart all 13 years. They helped launch this thing and took an interest from the get-go. And we are so deeply appreciative. And now more recently, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, which is supporting a number of programs at NBR, including this one. We are terrifically appreciative of that and them. In any case, thank you so much. Now, Senator Sessions, what a pleasure to have you here. And we were having our NBR board meeting yesterday, and there was a planning session toward the end of that board meeting, and Ashley was leading a discussion, or was scheduled to lead a discussion among these premier scholars we kind of handpicked to come in and talk to the board. And, you know, we're looking at our watches, and Ashley's late, a little later. You rarely find on the Hill, and I was mentioning to Senator Sessions that I work for Slade Gorton, senators have busy schedules, and so many of them really don't have time to listen and participate in a discussion and get in depth during the day, you know. But Ashley went up there, and Senator Sessions, an indication of his dedication to American national security, and his expertise and his devotion to developing even greater expertise on national security questions, and in particular strategic issues, was indicative of the time he spent with Ashley. So as we were looking at our watches, good work was being done on the Hill. And so it was worth it, and we really appreciate the time you spent, Senator. Just a couple things on Senator Sessions. You know, he's a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, of course, and ranking member of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. So, boy, that is a strategic person here for us today. I cannot tell you. He is on a number of course, subcommittees and other committees, but for our purposes today, he has really he's really one of the most positioned and the most caring about his topic representatives of the American people we have in Congress, and the Senate is a much better place because of your service there, sir. Thank you so much, and I'd like to turn this over to you.
Well, thank you all. It's a pleasure to be here and share with you some thoughts and some of the matters that are challenging America today. I appreciate our host, Mike, and all of you and NBR. I think it's the kind of thing that's important to America. I guess this topic, the second nuclear age, particularly with regard to Asia, as I've thought about what I would share with you, represents a very significant point in American history in which we are called upon to decide whether or not we will maintain our status as a premier nuclear power, whether our allies understand what our commitments are, whether we will follow up on those commitments, and or whether we may be seduced away on the siren call that peace and stability comes from something other than strength, and those kind of questions. So I really think the different rhetoric over United States nuclear posture is more dramatic than any other area of our nuclear, any other area of our defense structure. So I just want to say that to you. So I think it's a very, very important issue. Asia and the United States just continue to have such powerful relationships. I grew up in rural Alabama, and a Chinese company is right now one of the Golden Dragon Copper, a large company, is building a plant there, going to hire a lot of people. And, of course, Hyundai, South Korean automobile manufacturer, a few years ago, spent $1 billion to develop a plant in Alabama to make the Sonata automobile, one of the most popular in the United States, right in the state, with 4,000 Alabamians working in the main plant and all kinds of suppliers out there. And Toyota has got an engine plant with several thousand workers. Honda has an automobile plant with over 4,000 workers. Mercedes has an automobile plant with over 4,000 workers. All of those doing well and expanding. So I guess the whole concept of our relationship with the world is growing tighter in that sense every day, and we need to consider the role that nuclear weapons plays, that umbrella, the partnership, and how we go forward. I'm not sure enough thought has been given to it. Matter of fact, I'm sure enough thought hasn't been given to it, and I look forward to making some remarks and then maybe entering into a dialogue with you. One of the things that happens as your hair gets a bit older, grayer, and you stay around this Senate longer is that you should develop a little more humility. So I'll just give you my thoughts, and they come from a conservative Republican. So others may have different views, and they may be right and I may be wrong. I'll just share with you, frankly, where I'm coming from, where I see the issues and the challenges that we'll be facing in Congress. But the government is shut down, but the sun came up this morning. I see most of you look fine. There was food on the table, so somehow we'll muddle through this difficult time, I'm sure. It's not a healthy thing. We did fund the Defense Department, make sure our soldiers get paid. That was done yesterday, I believe. So, as ranking member of the Strategic Forces Committee on Armed Services, and I've been on that committee, ranking member, chairman of it, for the 16 years I've been in the Senate, we've been wrestling with the issues that you're talking about today. I don't think the whole Senate has fully engaged in them, but we've been working on them, and things have pretty well gone like we expect. Let me just say to you, you read a lot about partisanship, but under Senator Levin, under Senator McCain, and others, we tend to have a unanimous armed services bill every year. Occasionally we'll have a dispute over some extraneous issue, but fundamentally we've been united in our legislation and what we move out. On Strategic Committee, there was discussions, and I thought we'd have a pretty big fight over missile defense, but we've sort of maintained unity over defense over a few disputes that we've had, and we've not had a dispute over nuclear weapons in the 16 years. I mean, a fundamental disagreement about how we handle our nuclear weapons, but that could be changing now. We could be moving to a point where we've got to make some decisions. Our nation is going to have to make some commitments about what we want to do for the future. So I would think that represents a major event. For more than seven decades, our nuclear arsenal has helped maintain, in my view, relative peace and security around the world, particularly among major powers. I believe that's a positive fact. I don't believe it's caused wars, and somehow we've avoided the dread nuclear war. As Dr. Tellis said in the first chapter of Age in the Second Nuclear Age, quote, Nuclear weapons have contributed toward preserving the longest peace witnessed in modern European history. I guess that's true, and I think that's fair to say. Not only have U.S. nuclear weapons provided deterrent value, they've assured our friends and allies around the world, and few would doubt these weapons have been central in preventing major wars. There has been, I believe, within the United States, a bipartisan consensus on this, and I think there's been an international consensus among the United States and our allies around the world for decades now. But President Obama has made some statements that suggest a fundamentally different approach, a different view. A few months ago in June, during a speech at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, the president said, quote, "So long as nuclear weapons exist, we are not truly safe," close quote. Well, those words have ramifications. Does it suggest that, what does it suggest? First, I would say I don't think that's correct. I wouldn't agree with that phrase. I don't know how much thought they gave to it, but I don't think so. Certainly, it has been the United States nuclear arsenal supporting our credibility around the world that would always have the strength and it would reflect our political will to fulfill our security commitments. And it has been the bedrock, really, of mutual safety and our alliance. So the idea that we would strive toward this phrase of global zero, a world without nuclear weapons, is troubling to me. I think it raises concerns that we need to think through. It's become the public position of this administration, really. So many of you are probably aware that our former colleague and friend Chuck Hagel, now the Secretary of Defense, was one of four co-authors of a May 2012, just a little over a year ago, report produced by the Global Zero Foundation that called for radical cuts, I don't think there's any other way to describe it, to the U.S. nuclear stockpile and triad, and alarming reductions to our nuclear strategic readiness. Let me share with you some of the proposals in the report that he and his other three authors proposed. Reduce our strategic nuclear weapons from 1550 to a maximum of 900. Of these 900, half, 450, would be deployed. Half would be placed in storage or reserve. But the deployed weapons would all be de-alerted. There would be no nuclear weapons on alert. It would call for the elimination of all land-based ICBMs, the elimination of all tactical nuclear weapons, reducing our submarines from 14 to 10, decommissioning all B-52 bombers, and restructuring or downsizing our plans for nuclear modernization. Now, that's the contrary position to where we've been going for 70 years. It represents a challenge to our current thinking. So maybe this is healthy for us to think through it all. This Global Zero organization, President Obama has endorsed it strongly. On the second page of that report, President Obama is quoted as saying, "Global Zero will always have a partner in me and my administration." The Nuclear Posture Review that came out in April of 2010, not long after the president took office, has 30 references. 30 times it uses the phrase, or similar phrases, "a world without nuclear weapons." This is Defense Department's Nuclear Posture Review in 2010. And I've been raising concern about that for some time. It makes me nervous. But the Defense Department is repeatedly stating in their official report that they'd like to move to a world without nuclear weapons. So I remember having a conversation with Dr. Schlesinger, James Schlesinger, who was co-chairman of the Schlesinger-Perry nuclear report, that I think worked through in a bipartisan way, in a tough way, reaffirmed fundamentally our long-term nuclear strategy for America. I thought it was a very valuable report. I put in language in the defense bill that called for that bipartisan analysis. What was it, 2 years ago now, a little over two years ago now, that report came out. So we're talking to Dr. Schlesinger about this. He said, well, you know, Americans are goal-oriented. He's so wise, if you know. He said they're goal-oriented, and if you tell Americans our goal is to have zero nuclear weapons, they'll go to work and achieve it. But in Europe, it's quite different. Tony Blair just launched a nuclear submarine, and his whole speech was decrying having nuclear weapons in the world. The Europeans are used to this ambiguity. But I do think it's not a healthy thing that our public goal is to have zero nuclear weapons. Now, the president is made clear that nuclear proliferation is a danger to us, and says that should be one of our top priorities to prevent that. And we've emphasized, however, our negotiations with Russia primarily in all of this. But nothing, I think, demonstrates the perverse nature of our world, the difficult nature of our world, and the hollowness of a nuclear disarmament vision as the international community's inability to keep regimes such as North Korea and Iran from having nuclear weapons. So if our goal is to stop the proliferation, we haven't been very well at, have not done very well at it. In reducing our stockpile, I asked the question, will that stop proliferation? Will it stop other nations from advancing their nuclear powers? The primary driver for these regimes, let's be clear, is not the size of America's nuclear arsenal. They're not interested. They're not concerned about it. They want to know about theirs. And is it important to them? If they think it's critical to them and they have the ability to do it, they're going to proceed with it. And things get more dicey, in my view, if our capacity is continually being reduced and there's more uncertainty about our willingness to modernize or utilize it in a situation that it might arise. Our countries have their own interest. I was with a Russian official and a Russian professor at lunch a couple of years ago. And I said, well, what do you think about going to zero nuclear weapons? What's your position on this subject? And he said, do you know how many divisions China has on our border? We're never giving up nuclear weapons. And I think that's the Russian position. I think other nations have the same view. They are not going to give up their nuclear weapons if we go to zero in the United States. Now, Dr. Tallis said that nuclear weapons have become a permanent feature of international politics. I think that's true, and they're not going away. So we have to deal with that reality. China and Asia, we'll just look at the Asian picture. They continue a two-decade-long military buildup, and two of its key features have been the development of a sophisticated conventional missiles as well as nuclear modernization efforts. According to Tom Monken, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy, now a scholar at the Naval War College and John Hopkins, last year China tested new intercontinental ballistic missile, the DF-41, which reportedly features multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, or MIRVs. China is also testing its new JL-2 submarine-launched ballistic missile. And, of course, China builds its... While they build their nuclear arsenal and expands the role for potential use of nuclear weapons, they are unconstrained by New START, this treaty that constrains our ability to act. North Korea's nuclear program continues to advance with their nuclear program underway for 20 years. North Koreans earlier this year conducted their third nuclear test in 7 years. North Korea has conducted several rocket launches, and they successfully launched the Unha 3 long-range rocket satellite into orbit. Launched the satellite into orbit. And this uses the same technology as the Taepodong 2. Russia, according to the U.S. National Intelligence Council Global Trends in 2030, their 2030 report said the nuclear ambitions in the U.S. and Russia over the last 20 years have evolved in different directions. Reducing the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. security strategy is a U.S. objective, while Russia is producing new concepts and capabilities for expanding the role of nuclear weapons in its security strategy. Pakistan, according to Harvard scholar Shashank Joshi, Pakistan possesses what is thought to be the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world, and if present trends continue, could equal or surpass Britain's stockpile within a decade. India, only 2 months ago in August, India activated the reactor of its first indigenously built ballistic missile submarine. They built a submarine. Most notably, this SSBN submarine, once it is ready to conduct deterrence patrols, will mark the completion of India's nuclear triad. Well, yet we continue to speak about a world without nuclear weapons and devalue and diminish the role of U.S. weapons. President, this was a dramatic event to me. I think it got much attention in Asia, not so much in the United States. Excuse me. President Obama's remarks in Korea, 2012, quote, "As president, I changed our nuclear posture to reduce the number and role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy. I made it clear the United States will not develop new nuclear warheads, and we will not pursue new military missions for nuclear weapons. We've narrowed the range of contingencies under which we would ever use or threaten to use nuclear weapons," close quote. Well, I'm sure it did cause unease among our allies. So it wasn't long after that, Deputy Secretary of Defense Ash Carter went to the region to smooth over or reassure, saying, quote, "We will continue to provide the extended deterrence offered by the U.S. nuclear umbrella," close quote. So we say one thing, then we have to come back and say another. So I'm a little worried about this confusion. According to the New York Times report from earlier this year, the former leader of South Korean governing party and son of the founder of Hyundai Industrial Group said, quote, "In South Korea, the Americans don't feel the North Korean nuclear weapons as a direct threat. At a time of crisis, we are not 100% sure whether Americans will cover us with their nuclear umbrella," close quote. We've been hearing these kind of things privately. Korean newspaper Mr. Chung Sung-hoon of the Korean Institute for National Unification wrote, "South Korea must look closely at how it will affect the U.S. pledge to provide security and a nuclear umbrella. Exposed to a North Korean threat, Seoul cannot support the idea unconditionally. A particular concern is the effect on the U.S. promise to stop nuclear proliferation." And it goes on, there were others there. The Congressional Resource Report, our group that does research, these are scholars that work on various things we give to them. They don't really speak for the United States government, said, quote, "Given Japan's reliance on U.S. extended deterrence, Tokyo is wary of any changes in U.S. policy, however subtle, that might alter the nuclear status quo in East Asia." I believe that's absolutely correct. Op-ed in the New York Times by Isaac Stonefish, quote, "Japan has reason to be concerned that Obama and the Xi Jinping summit weakened the U.S. commitment to defending Japan. So, the bottom line, we need to do a better job of reassuring our allies and partners and clarifying our position, I think. And so you're helping us with that, I believe. And briefly, we got time. Briefly, I'd sort of bring you up to date. At Strategic Subcommittee, we deal with the funding and the budgets in the Armed Services Committee on this, at least the authorization for funding. The ultimate funding comes from the Appropriations Committee and is a separate matter. We've had a pretty good unanimous view about this, but tension is arising over whether or not we're on track to fulfill all the necessities, I believe, that a robust arsenal requires. So earlier in June, the Senate Armed Services Committee fully funded. Pete, our vote on the Armed Services bill again this year was it unanimous in committee, or do we have we had a budget dispute that might have knocked out the unanimous vote in committee? But other than that, on the policy, I think our committee was unanimous. But okay. So the Armed Services Committee fully funded the President's request for the NNSA, our Nuclear Weapons Production Activities. Unfortunately, the President's request fell short of the New START commitment that he made. When New START was passed, Senator John Kyle was so active in all that. I think he had a really sound view of United States' strategic role in the world, and he got a letter from the President committing to do certain things. And so to secure Senate support for New START, the President committed to increase funding for nuclear weapon activities by $4.1 billion over the years of 12 through 16, taking into account congressional action, sequester cuts, shortfalls in administration funding requests. That increase will not be fully funded. It'll be scaled back by $1.4 billion, or 34%. The increase there that we need to modernize our forces. These aging weapons have got to be modernized, and questions are being raised about their effectiveness if we don't do it. In FY12, $385 million was cut by Congress. In FY13, the administration request fell short by $343 million, while an additional $600 million was cut due to the sequester, which has fallen too hard on our Defense Department, but does not leave us unable to fund the robust nuclear weapon modernization program. In FY14, request fell $285 million short. So the life extension program for the B-61 nuclear bomb was delayed 2 years in the FY13 request and now is likely to be delayed another 6 to 12 months, pushing it beyond FY19, which creates some risk associated with a component in the bomb reaching its end of its life. In FY13, we were told of a 3-year slip for the life extension program for the W-78 and W-88 interoperable warheads, according to the FY14 Stockpile Stewardship Management Plan. The date for that program has slipped another year. On the Triad, the nuclear Triad, the Ohio-class nuclear submarine has been replacement has been delayed by 2 years, leaving us with no slack in the date. They say we need that new submarine. A long-range standoff missile, a replacement for the nuclear air-launched cruise missile first deployed in 1980. That award was delayed 2 years. After 3 years of study, the next generation bomb appears ready to move forward with development, and the administration supports that. It requires the bomber be nuclear certified within 2 years after deployment. And so there are other things going on. So the bottom line is that we're sliding in ways that I think create risks that we should not be taking. And the gap continues to grow between what was deemed necessary to modernize our nuclear forces at the time of the New START Treaty and what has occurred since the Senate provided its advice and consent to that treaty in 2010. So, while it may be fashionable in some circles to suggest that advocating a strong nuclear deterrent is antiquated or a remnant of Cold War thinking, nothing could be further from the truth, in my view. Unfortunately, the world is not a safe place. At a time when chaos and mistrust rule the day in many places around the world, weakness or uncertainty is not an option. We cannot be in the business of yielding U.S. primacy. It's not necessary. It should not be a policy of our government, and it's not going to be beneficial, I think, to stability. So in these uncertain times, we need to speak clearly and consistently. We need to be clear as a nation about the need to protect the United States and our allies through nuclear weapons if necessary, and to guard against any unwise policy that would destabilize the world scene. So it is great to be with you, and it was a delight to talk to Dr. Tellis. And I think all of us, maybe in Congress, and all the busy things that we do, and we're so involved every day, and we have the opportunity to draw on the best minds, many of them in this room, to help us think through these issues. That's really the reason I ask for the Perry Schlesinger Report, to get the best minds we have to try to give us advice about what we should do in the future. And they came forward with a bipartisan suggestion that was clear and strong. But in recent months, it seems to me that some of that clarity is slipping away, which I think is unfortunate. But Congress will hold, I believe. I think there'll be a bipartisan support for maintaining a strong nuclear policy. But we got to be careful that as we go forward, that the impression given throughout the world is not the wrong one. Thank you for letting me be with you, and I'd be delighted to try to share some thoughts and answer any questions you might have.
Senator, I'm Vice Admiral Jay Hall. I appreciate you coming to speak with us.
Thank you.
The Ohio replacement program presents a big... Oh, I'm sorry.
The Ohio replacement program presents a big future bill in the Department of Defense, and there have been some suggestions that that be funded either outside of the Navy's budget or that a $2 billion a year plus up be put into the Navy's shipbuilding budget in order to fund that program without severe impact on other shipbuilding programs that the Navy would also pursue during that 12-year period of time. Do you think that has any chance, or is there any traction for that concept within the Senate?
I doubt right now that it is, unless you can tell me where the $2 billion is going to come from. We're not going to borrow it. Look, under the Budget Control Act, Congress approved a reduction in the growth of spending by $2 trillion, 2.1, in exchange for agreeing to raise the debt ceiling $2.1 trillion. Well, we've already borrowed another $2.1 trillion, so now we have another debt ceiling debate. But in the course of that, a big agreement was hoped to be reached that would have dealt with entitlements and long-term funding, and it was not reached. And it said if that didn't happen, there would be automatic cuts across the board, and they fell too heavily on the Defense Department. The Defense Department represents one-sixth of the U.S. budget, and it got one-half of the cuts. And I'm ranking Republican on the Budget Committee, and I'm know these numbers. So I'm really worried that we're doing too much, but we can't get any agreement from the administration to find any other reductions in spending because whole areas of the government got zero cuts. And so I don't think Congress is going to vote to break the Budget Control Act. The president signed it. Congress voted for it. It's bypassed both houses. And it would be unthinkable that a couple of years later, we can't adhere to that. So where do you get the $2 billion? It'd really be fought within the, probably in the Defense Department to find that money. And I know a lot of people think that you can just we can ask for it and it's going to happen. But there is a reality that spending is tight. The Defense Department is getting too much of a cut, in my opinion. But the choice is a real stark one. If you can't get the administration to agree to find other reductions, then will you break the budget we agreed to or not? And I don't think the decision will be made to break the Budget Control Act spending limits. But I think it's incumbent upon us on all of these programs to, you know, push back and let there be competition between the Navy need for Ohio class as compared to how many soldiers the Army needs or how many airplanes the Air Force needs. And we have a more robust, instead of stovepiping all these funds, and we have more of a competition for priorities throughout the system. But I did want to share that with you. Maybe my staff can help me, but the spending on our nuclear arsenal represents a very small percentage of the total, 4%, Pete, 4% of the total defense budget. So to me, it's a bedrock part of our defense posture. And the 4% that goes to that does not have to be reduced on budgetary reasons if it's necessary to maintain that bedrock part of our Defense Department. Now, I think I have a suspicion, and I've been critical of the Department of Energy, who actually produces this. For institutional reasons, they don't have any interest in reducing cost. So they just say, well, we need a nuclear bomb. Well, we want so much money. Nobody else can build it. They say, well, we've got to be safe, you know, we've got, and they need more and more and more. So the cost just goes up. They wanted to build two buildings, new buildings, that were going to cost $11 or $12 billion to build the building. ThyssenKrupp built the biggest steel mill, I guess, almost in the world from scratch in Alabama. They spent $4 billion on it. I mean, I don't think we need to spend $12 billion to build two buildings. So that's cut back. And we were able to put a cap on how much spending went into building buildings for the Department of Energy and their labs. So, but the danger there is if you could delay, compromise our ability if we cut it too much to maintain a core part of our defense system. Yes.
Oh. Hi. Sorry, I already have a mic. My name's Ann Daly, and I'm a student at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Senator Sessions, thank you so much for coming here. And also, I just wanted to note that I very much appreciate your sincerity and the disclaimer that you're a conservative senator, and yours are not the only views. That's refreshing to hear in this environment. My question has to do with sort of some of the things you mentioned in your last response, that we're facing tough decisions, stark decisions, and spending is tight. Given the fact that the conflicts that the United States has been involved with in the past 20 years have been sub-state or intra-state or non-state actors, and the fact that we have, I think, two or three times more weapons in our arsenal than the next closest nuclear state, and that nuclear weapons are a state-to-state issue and not a non-state or sub-state issue, if there is a way that we could reduce the size of our arsenal while still fulfilling the missions of homeland defense and extended deterrence that we owe to our allies, isn't that something that we should support given budget constraints and the need to be able to fund things like pensions for the soldiers who've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan for the last 10 years?
Well, it's a good question and a fair question. We do need to look at cost, and we've brought down our nuclear weapons dramatically. I think we had as many as 20, 40,000 nuclear weapons after World War II. We were down to, we went to 2,400. Now we're going on the New START to 1,500. That's getting at the margin. And now the president's talking about another one-third. He's publicly stated he'd like to do another. He believes we can reduce nuclear weapons by another one-third to 1,000. So this puts us in a position, in my opinion, that our nuclear competitors could easily see, aha, well, I can be a peer competitor of the United States. And we're seeing other nations expanding their nuclear programs, growing their nuclear weapons. We're the only nuclear power in the world that has no capacity now to manufacture new nuclear weapons. And so I think it's we're getting at a point where the world, we're creating instability in the world. And it's, as I indicated, the cost of it is not as large as most people think. So perversely or oddly, the more our leaders, the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States, talk about a world without nuclear weapons, I think creates among our allies concern over whether or not they need to have nuclear weapons. So, in effect, it could proliferate nuclear weapons in the process of that. And I don't think the world would be a more stable place if multiple nations were basically peer competitors to the United States. But we do have a sophisticated system. We have great targeting capability. We don't need as many as a lot of nations might need to have the same power. But there's some political, psychological effects of too rapid a drawdown that we need to consider, in my opinion.
Yeah. My name is Thomas Christian. I'm a current postgraduate school fellow at the Department of Energy in NSA, where I focus on counterproliferation. I'm curious.
You've been watching our money carefully, I know. That's right. It's somebody else in the energy that spends too much.
I'm curious what advice you might be able to give young professionals who are in this field, given your statements that from the executive branch, policy has been seemingly slipping over the past few years. So what advice could you give young professionals who are in this field or going into this field?
You mean as nuclear engineers or just as...
In general, in nuclear security.
Security issues. I think it's going to be a very exciting, I guess, period, because we're going to be the stability of the last 50 years is eroding a bit. We're reevaluating what our future will be, so I think it would be an interesting time. And like your report here, the more change is in the air, the more exciting and the more potential it is. So I think it would be a good feel for people. Nuclear weapons are not going away. China's not giving up its weapons. India's not giving up its weapons. Pakistan is not. And Russia surely is not. And we are not either. But there's going to be a lot of discussion and tension, I think, in the years to come about exactly how many, how they should be configured, and what impacts that has around the globe. All right, I think she's got.
We will have this one last question.
All right.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Jin Ninh Nguyen. I'm with Voice of Vietnamese Americans, and I'm from Southeast Asia. So I think there's a question about geopolitical situation regarding the nuclear power. And I come back to all the questions raised and your points of cutting funding more or less and the nuclear weapons in our budget for defense. So I would like to ask you, since you're in the budget committee, about the QDR. And I think there's a difference that the First Lady raised of the sophistication, the quality of our weapons compared to the quantity. And I also heard that in the QDR, there is a severe cut in our numbers of troops. And the humanity, the human resource is being suffering because of the healthcare cost. So that came back to the question of today, of the shutdown. So you know that this morning, the president has announced that he has to cut short the trip to Asia. And I don't think the trip to Asia would cost $2 billion, but that give out the significant psychological effect on our allies. So I respect your position as a ranking member in our committee and the Senate. What would you think, what can you do to, with the least amount of money, project the best posture in the defense impact of the U.S. in Asia right at this moment? And as a Vietnamese, I'm very much concerned. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I guess that's, I think it's a fair question. I suspect it wasn't so much the money as he's got a problem at home he needs to take care of. We got a difficult thing. The government is being shut down in large part, and not so much our military people, but the other parts of the government are. And so it's a big deal. We don't have an agreement. I pointed out the other day that according to the Government Accountability Office, our independent accounting office, that the Obamacare bill will add $6.2 trillion over 75 years to the debt of the United States. That's almost as much as the 7.7 of Social Security. And some think if we get the real numbers, it's going to look worse than that. I think that would be the low side of the number. So at a time of financial problem, a new law that's about to take place is unsustainable financially if in big amount. So we need to be saving Social Security and Medicare, and the question is, can we afford a new unfunded liability, and what will happen? The debt is so large that by 2018, I believe that's the date, thereabouts, interest on our debt will exceed the defense budget. It will almost exceed Social Security, which I guess is the largest single payment item that we make. So we're in a discussion, and there's tension over how to deal with the future. The president would like to raise taxes and spend more, spend that, and the Congress doesn't want to raise taxes anymore. And so we're in a disagreement. And so somehow it's got to be worked out. He probably needs to be here and see if he can help maneuver this out, and it'll work out sooner or later, hopefully sooner. But it is a difficult financial challenge for us, and there's some good people on both sides of it, but that would be my concern. And look, let me go back. I raise concerns as a person who's been on the strategic committee for 16 years. I don't like some of the words I'm hearing. So you challenge Senator, my friend Chuck Hagel, or the president's staff, and they'll say, well, zero, it may not be in our lifetime, but that's our goal. And then we're having to fight hard over budgets. And particularly these areas of strategic power in our budgets. And so I guess I'm saying we haven't gone off the cliff. We haven't made a firm decision not to maintain our traditional role, not to operate in the vision of the Perry Schlesinger report of just a couple of years ago that was bipartisan. Some of our best minds we have in the world, in the United States, and that wrestled with these, what our role should be in the future. I think we may well be able to hold to that. But I'm a bit uneasy. I think our allies are being placed in an uneasy position. I think they're going to have to they probably are wondering whether they now need to have their own nuclear weapons if they can't depend on the United States. And the sooner we get clarity in our message, the better off we'll be. And uncertainty can cause wars more than clarity normally. And so that's kind of where I see it. I do think our Armed Services Committee in the Senate, and I'm sure in the House, will hold the line and maintain at least a minimum capabilities with regard to nuclear power, and I hope we'll be able to restore some clarity so that our allies know exactly where we are, and then they can make their decisions for what's best for them. So thank you. Great to be with you. It's a good group.
We could not have had a better start. This sets the stage for us now to discuss one of the most important issues in American national security, and your clarity was, and gentlemanly delivery of that clarity was really, they were really appreciated. Thank you so much.
We got to go back and find some money.
All right, well, we're going to start with the first panel. There's no a break for the weary here. So if the first panel, and Charles, can you bring them up? Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, welcome to the Elliott School again. I'm Charles Glazer, and I run the Institute for Security and Conflict Studies here at the Elliott School. So today's first full panel is on Asia's nuclear powers. As we'll hear later in the session, we are countries in Asia. We're worried about whether they're going to be nuclear powers. But today's first panel is on China, India, and Pakistan, all of which are nuclear powers. I have the hard job of keeping us on track time-wise, so that will be the only major thing I have to do. But we have three very impressive presenters. We've lost a little bit of time because of Senator Sessions answered so many questions, which was very nice of him. So we have about three 10-minute presentations. My job is to keep the presenters on track, and then we have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions. So I'm going to do very brief introductions, and then we'll start in the order of the panel as they're up here. So we have Abram Denmark is Vice President for Political and Security Affairs at NBR, and he's had significant experience both inside and outside of government. He's worked as a fellow at the Center for New American Security, and he served in the Pentagon. Then we'll go to our second speaker, Gaurav Kapani. He's currently at the Transnational Postdoctoral Fellow for International Relations and Security at the Norwegian Institute of Defense Studies in Oslo, the Center for Security Studies in Zurich, and the RAND Corporation in D.C. So he covers, he's in many places at one time, according to his bio here.
In succession.
No, I assume it was not simultaneous, but still that's a handful. And then our third speaker today is Christopher Clary, who's a PhD student in political science at MIT. He's now a Stanton Fellow at the RAND Corporation, and before that he served as a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow for South Asian Affairs and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. So let's start right away. We'll go to Abe for 10 minutes. 10 minutes for anybody who's written a chapter is a real challenge, so I hope that you guys can condense your arguments, and then we'll move right along to questions. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I have the happy pleasure of being able to present a chapter that I didn't write. So as an author, it's very easy for me to as a non-author, it's easy for me to condense. I'm usually in these sort of situations, I begin by thanking the organizers. But in this case, I wanted to just thank everybody for coming this morning, and especially thank my fellow panelists for presenting their papers. I also wanted to mention that Chris Clary and I actually served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense at the same time, me working on China issues and him working on Pakistan. So it's a lot of late nights slaving away inside the Pentagon with Chris. So I'm have the happy privilege of presenting Jeffrey Lewis's paper. It's a fantastic chapter on China's nuclear strategies and China's nuclear posture. So I'll be presenting his arguments as written in the chapter, and it puts me in a very comfortable position during the Q&A so that everything you disagree with is something that I didn't write, and everything that you do agree with I can try to expound upon in the Q&A. So if there's one word that should describe how the U.S. has understood China's nuclear policy and posture in the past, a good word for it would be surprise. That in 1964, with China's first nuclear test, the United States was surprised that China both possessed enough fissile material to produce a bomb and was also further surprised that China had used highly enriched uranium for that bomb instead of plutonium. We've also been surprised over the years that China's nuclear arsenal has been relatively small and vulnerable, and some say somewhat provocatively vulnerable, and that it has a few hundred warheads for ballistic missiles, which are stored separately, and a no-first-use policy, which I'll explain later. But broadly speaking, because of this surprise that we've felt with China's nuclear posture in the past, there needs to be an element of humility when analyzing China's nuclear forces, recognizing that culture, politics, and ideology all conspire to prevent a full external understanding. So broadly, I'll go through the history of China's nuclear weapons and missile development, which is broken down into two phases. The first being fairly technological determinism, beginning in the late 1950s and operating through the 1980s, in which China sought to possess the same sophisticated weapons as other major powers, all the while referring to nuclear weapons as a paper tiger. China embarked on a program, an initiative called 8 Years, Four Missiles, in which they, in 8 years, tried to develop four missiles of various sophistication and capability, beginning with a large single-stage missile with one engine, developing to a missile with clustered engines, a stage missile, and finally an ICBM. This reflected a broader Maoist approach of setting high and often unrealistic goals, such as was seen in the Great Leap Forward, without a real understanding of what was involved in getting from point A to point Z. But in this case, unlike the Great Leap Forward, this was a somewhat successful effort on China's behalf, that China's nuclear capabilities saw rapid development of a technological capability, and that as the Cultural Revolution set in the 1960s, the research and development community of China really took over the military modernization and design, which is what kind of drove the technological determinist approach for those years. Things started to change in the 1990s when the People's Liberation Army really, and especially the 2nd Artillery Corps, took over a lot of the R&D and became the defense, the dominant factor in military and strategic force posture and policymaking. So we saw the gradual development of solid fuel ballistic missiles, mobile missile launchers, and eventually sea-based capabilities, which were at least somewhat more tightly tied to actual missions, actual perceived needs, rather than a pure sense of we need to get better things, more modern things in a fairly quick period. Although that element was there as well. So today, the key features of China's nuclear forces, posture, and policies is that the 2nd Artillery Corps, as I mentioned before, is mainly responsible for deterring other countries from using nuclear weapons against China and for conducting nuclear counterattacks and precision strikes with conventional missiles. China possesses a range of delivery systems, roughly 50 to 75 ICBMs, including 30 road mobile solid-fueled DF-31 and 31As. These are complemented by liquid-fueled IRBMs and road mobile solid-fueled medium-range ballistic missiles such as the DF-21 for regional deterrence missions. China has operationally deployed between 100 and 200 warheads. It is unclear how many of the DF-21s are nuclear-armed, so there's that ambiguity. China is also modernizing a lot of its delivery systems, including the JL-2 submarine launch ballistic missile, as well as the DF-41 MIRVed ICBM that Senator Sessions mentioned earlier. All of this being housed within a fairly robust no-first-use policy in which China commits to not be the first country to use nuclear weapons in any exchange, to not threaten use against non-nuclear powers, basically committing itself to absorb a nuclear strike and then preserving the ability to retaliate in kind. And this sort of restraint, I think, deserves some explanation. The chapter does a good job of explaining Chinese restraint in the nuclear field. It was mentioned earlier that China is not being constrained by New START, which is true. China is actually being self-constrained in that the no-first-use policy, as explained in the chapter, is seen by many folks as part of China's ideological heritage, part of its Maoist traditions, and is unlikely to be abandoned officially, even if China were to move away from it in an operational sense. The chapter explains or interprets the no-first-use policy to be a political statement about the role of nuclear weapons in warfare, and that nuclear weapons will not be decisive. It is not necessarily indicative of China's actual use or non-use of nuclear weapons in a conflict. In China, there is an ongoing debate about the role of nuclear weapons and concern that the no-first-use policy may become increasingly problematic for China's security within the context of precision strike, conventional precision strike, and in improving missile defense capabilities from the United States. So more recently, President Xi Jinping, in a speech to the 2nd Artillery Corps, told them that they need to be on high alert, which is a phraseology usually reserved for the United States and Russia, and was very rare for Chinese forces, which are usually not on that kind of alert status. And more recently, in China's most recent defense white paper, there was the standard language about the no-first-use policy was omitted from the official document. It was explained later on that China's not abandoning the no-first-use policy, that this was not an indication that they were abandoning no-first-use. But it is clear that there's a discussion happening within China's strategic community about this. But broadly speaking, nobody really is up to the level ideologically, politically, maybe even not Xi Jinping, to revise the Maoist dictums that they've inherited. It'll be more of an operational, if it happens, it would be more of an operational move away rather than a doctrinal explicit decision. So the impacts of all of this on strategic stability and regional security. Chinese planners manage a highly complex strategic environment. They need to account for the U.S., Russia, India, North Korea, and potential latent nuclear powers such as Japan. The book details a lot of these relationships. I'm going to focus on China and just a few remarks about India, U.S.-China nuclear dynamics, excuse me. U.S.-China nuclear dynamics for both China and the United States seem to be centered on Taiwan contingencies. China appears to believe that the U.S. will use nuclear threats to compel China to accept an independent Taiwan. Ironically, the United States, at least in many circles, is also concerned that China would threaten the use of nuclear weapons if unification seemed to be a lost cause. So there's an interesting parallel there. The United States has a range of extended deterrence guarantees that is a concern for China. And the key issue right now, and we can talk about this during the Q&A if people are interested, is whether or not the United States should accept mutual vulnerability with China. So far, the United States government has not made an explicit acceptance of mutual vulnerability, but something more tacit, recognizing China's deterrent and the practical inability of the United States to reliably negate it. China wants for its part, wants the United States to adopt a full no-first-use policy. For interests of time, I'll just gloss over and focus on implications for the United States for all of this, is that the continued ambiguity that we see for Chinese nuclear capabilities, doctrine, and plans is likely going to continue. China is not likely to enter into formal nuclear negotiations, either the next step from after a new start or whatever it may be. China does not feel that it's time for them to participate in these negotiations. The United States wants to achieve strategic stability with China and is slowly recognizing that China is neither a small Russia nor a large North Korea, but comes with it its own issues, its own approach to things, and needs a tailored strategy and a tailored approach that's specific for China's interests and concerns. There's an important non-alignment, as the chapter argues, between U.S. policy and strategic realities, primarily saying that the United States has not acknowledged mutual vulnerability. But there are some questions about this, this is my only addition for the whole presentation, when it comes to mutual vulnerability, questions that I think are important to raise. One, would accepting mutual vulnerability gain anything with China? If we were to say, yes, we're vulnerable to you, what would that actually accomplish in terms of strategic stability with the Chinese? And second, how would we manage the likely deleterious effects that such an acknowledgement would have with our alliance relationships? There's also concerns, and I'll stop with this point, as pointed out by the book, by the chapter, that there are concerns about Chinese efforts to signal resolve, that in a crisis, China, the way China writes about signaling resolve, the way China writes about crisis management, is that some of their efforts to signal resolve may be interpreted by the United States as highly escalatory, which leads to a great potential for misunderstanding and miscalculation, which I would add will only be intensified by the lack of transparency and lack of understanding that we continue to have about China and its nuclear capabilities, doctrine, and plans. And I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you very much. Gaurav.
Well, thanks, Charles, and thanks, Abe. So in the 10 minutes that I have, I'm going to focus on four aspects of my chapter. The first is the general direction in which India's nuclear weapons program is headed. Second, the operational distance that India has covered over the last decade and the challenges India's national security managers face in bringing the arsenal up to speed. Three, what are the implications for deterrent stability, crisis stability, arms control stability? And finally, what are the policy implications for the United States? So first things first, there are two ways. I mean, historically, India's nuclear weapons program has been framed in two ways. One, it is a prestige-driven enterprise, and the second, that it is driven by national security concerns. Now, the operational developments over the last decade have firmly rooted the Indian weapons program in the realist national security canon. On the hardware side, fission weapons are the key war horses in India's arsenal. If it is very unlikely that that the thermonuclear device has been weaponized. If boosted fission weapons exist, their reliability is questionable. Over the next 10 years, land-based ballistic missiles will become the centerpiece of the Indian arsenal. But still, India has a long way to go, especially as far as China is concerned. India has only recently begun testing intermediate-range ballistic missiles. There are some concerns that India would deploy an ICBM, but we may see a technology demonstration project, but we will see an operational capability over the next 10 years. Over the long term, India is headed towards developing SSBNs. This is classic secure second strike capability. There's a lot of buzz, and the senator mentioned recently, just now in the morning, about India's launch of its first SSBN, the S-2 or the Arihant. Now, a couple of caveats are in order. This is a technology demonstrator. It has a relatively small reactor. The missiles to be deployed in the submarine will all be short range. And in other words, India will not really have a secure second strike capability against China with this, the S-2 class of submarines. Even successive submarines, the S-3, the S-4, and the S-5, will not give India a secure second strike capability. India will require an entirely new class of submarines to safely operate out of the Bay of Bengal or the Arabian Sea to hold Chinese assets at risk. On the software side, and by this I mean doctrinal issues, the institutions, organizations, and procedures, at the doctrinal level, there are two key aspects. One is first use and massive retaliation. India remains committed to no first use, but at the military level, how India responds is a matter of context. According to India's Strategic Forces Command, targeting nuclear assets with precision conventional means, even in a first strike mode, is game. And as far as massive retaliation is concerned, this is mainly a rhetorical device. India's strategy, 10 years ago, Ashley Tellis remarked in his very famous book on India that sad statements to the contrary, states gravitate towards the lowest level of nuclear exchange, and this is also the case with India. And the Strategic Forces Command has gamed a series of scenarios, demonstration shots, use in tactical settings, use against battlefield area targets, and how India actually responds will depend upon the nature of the nuclear context. So we should not take massive retaliation at face value. There's far more nuance to India's operational strategy. At the procedural level, India's Strategic Forces Command is most concerned that India's nuclear forces might be caught flat-footed, and this is because of the disaggregated nature of the Indian arsenal. The warheads are controlled by two scientific agencies, which are civilian. The delivery systems are controlled by the armed services. And the procedure and the Strategic Forces Command actually has the procedural authority to put the warheads and the delivery systems together during a crisis and ultimately at the time of use. So how India transitions from this peacetime disaggregation to wartime aggregation is a big question mark, which has raised very serious concerns within India. But as India develops a sea-based capability, some of this disaggregation will disappear. More recently, claims have been made that India already maintains an aggregated arsenal, the short-range Agni-1 ballistic missile, which was deployed, according to Vipin Narang, for example, is canisterized and the warheads are integrated. I think the evidence is skimpy and we should treat these claims with skepticism. At the organizational level, India's Strategic Forces Command is institutionally separated from the rest of the armed services, which is all very good during peacetime, but again, during war, this raises massive questions about coordination between the conventional and the nuclear arms of the military. So what does all this mean in terms of deterrent stability, crisis stability, and arms control stability? Well, at the level of deterrent stability is concerned, India has a secure second strike capability against Pakistan, but also against China, and it will take about at least another 10 years before India develops an operational capability to do so. At the level of crisis stability, again, a lot depends. Crisis stability really depends upon the ability of states to communicate their intentions very clearly and then manipulate their forces organizationally within to ensure that what they communicate is in line with their actions on the ground. And as far as that is concerned, the institutional divide within India raises a lot of question marks about India's ability to respond operationally in a smooth manner. Organizationally, the separation within the Strategic Forces Command and the armed services raises questions how well India will coordinate its conventional and nuclear war strategy. Now, this has enormous implications for Pakistan, in the Indo-Pakistani dyad, and less so with China at present. But just to repeat, this has been said before, but Pakistan's engaged in asymmetric war against India. India has historically responded by a strategy of denial. Gradually, the Indian military has shifted to a strategy of punishing the Pakistani military. If the Indians decide to act, it will require enormous coordination between the conventional and the nuclear arms of the military, and there is no central coordinating authority within the military to do so. So this raises serious question marks. Then finally, the question of arms control stability in the region. Again, a lot of questions in that India is developing a Mervin capability and also a missile defense. And as far as Mervin capability is concerned, it is at this point primarily restricted to the intermediate range ballistic missiles, which have significance for China largely. But again, I think a lot of analysts ignore the fact that India's warhead capability is very limited, and this is one of the key reasons that's driving India's Mervin program. As far as ballistic missile defense is concerned, the Indian defense agencies have been very boastful, but they should be taken with these claims should be taken with a bucket full of salt. Mm-hmm. You've had 7 tests, 6 have been successful in highly rigged conditions. These have not been operationally tested, and so the Indian capability on the ground is far more prosaic than the Indian defense agencies make them out to be. So what are the policy implications for the United States? For one, India's emergence as a serious nuclear power, the United States is partially responsible for it. Thanks to the Indo-US nuclear rapprochement, India has greater access to fissile material, better access to dual-use technologies, and can directly now purchase delivery systems such as nuclear submarines and help in ballistic missiles from other advanced industrial states, particularly Russia. The implications for India's emergence as a serious nuclear power has a medium-term and a short-term implication. In the medium term, of course, it will address the asymmetric, or will address the asymmetries in the balance of power in Asia, especially vis-à-vis China. It will enable India to stand up to potential Chinese bullying and participate in quasi-alliances or partnerships with greater confidence. But in the short term, there are serious issues about deterrence instability and crisis and instability in the region. The deterrence instability flows from the gaps in material Indian capabilities. At the United States has a choice. It can continue its passive approach that it's followed in the past, or it can follow a more proactive approach, the way it followed towards the French, negative assistance or negative advice. In the short term, however, the region is prone to crisis instability, and not just because of India's organizational and institutional weaknesses, but also because of Pakistan's approach to fighting an asymmetric war in the subcontinent. And again, the U.S. approach in the past has been what I call the Band-Aid approach, which is intervene during crisis and urge arms control, and the U.S. has the option of putting the pressure on Pakistan to kind of lay off this asymmetric war strategy. And thus far, Indian nuclear arms buildup has not elicited a direct response from China. China has responded indirectly by arming Pakistan with the goal of boxing India in South Asia. But should Chinese respond directly to an Indian threat through the buildup of the intermediate range forces, it would have implications for the credibility of U.S. extended guarantees in Asia, and also and make reductions in the U.S. arsenal rather difficult. And in the case of South Asia, of course, the United States should be most concerned with Pakistan, which is the problem child of South Asia, and it has the fastest growing nuclear arms arsenal in the world, and any implosion in the Pakistani state or a weakening of the Pakistani state authority has enormous implications for nuclear terrorism or the unauthorized use of nuclear weapons.
Great. Thank you very much. And with that comment on Pakistan, we lead right into Chris's paper. So thank you.
Thank you. If Pakistan is the problem child of Asia, I'm hoping to be the problem child of this panel. I obviously won't be able to capture the full richness and some would say beauty of my chapter. So buy the book. If you're a faculty member, assign it to your syllabi, put it on the syllabi. If you're not a faculty member, the holiday season is approaching. I think nothing would make little Jimmy's eyes light up quite like getting Strategic Asia 2015 in the stocking. So let me walk you through the major elements of my chapter. I'll try to go quickly, both because we don't have a lot of time, and also Q&A is more interesting than prepared remarks. So Pakistan is assembling the constituent elements necessary for a battlefield nuclear capability. So that's my sort of bottom line. That's why one bumper sticker you should take away. But let me back it up. Let me complicate the bumper sticker. I'm a graduate student. Even my bumper stickers have footnotes. The evidence does not yet indicate they have made the necessary doctrinal or operational changes to actually have a battlefield nuclear capability. But instead, I'm saying that they have the building blocks to do so in the future. So what are those building blocks? What are the major elements you would need? First, very short-range ballistic missiles. They have the Hadaf 9 Nasser, first tested in 2011. One question I had at the outset of the chapter was whether it was reasonable to believe Pakistan, or a state like Pakistan, could mount its nuclear warheads on a missile with a relatively small diameter. Let's say the Nasser has a diameter on the order of 400 millimeters. I concluded that it was reasonable, that a state of Pakistan's technological development probably could do so. The U.S. was fielding a 280-millimeter diameter, highly enriched uranium device, the W-9 warhead, by about 1952. The U.S. had done more testing by 1952 than Pakistan has. But given advances in computer modeling and the possibility of Chinese assistance, it seems to me quite plausible that Pakistan could have miniaturized warheads to fit atop the Nasser. As a final point, I did not conclude necessarily that Pakistan has the capability to develop nuclear artillery, i.e. warheads actually fired from artillery. You hear that rumor of interest in nuclear artillery by Pakistan in Track 2 forums. You see it occasionally in the press. But this would require far greater miniaturization. The Pakistani artillery is the largest artillery that Pakistan has, is about 203 millimeters. The United States did not achieve this capability until 1957, using, according to what one gathers from open sources, a W-33 warhead, which has a sort of complicated double gun style warhead, according to open source reports. So was that in the weeds enough for everybody? But sometimes getting to the weeds mattered because I was in New Delhi quite recently and talking to somebody who's quite well-informed in the Indian establishment, and he was telling me he didn't think Pakistan could mount its warhead on the Nasser, and he thought that it was just kind of a bluff to mostly scare the United States to put pressure on India and maybe scare Indian civilian leaders. And so, you know, if you come to the conclusion that I did, that it's very possible that it's not a bluff, that takes you down a different path. It might be tough, it is true, for Pakistan to mount plutonium warheads on the Nasser, but Pakistan has a lot of highly enriched uranium sitting around, and to my mind, they can plausibly put it atop the Nasser. Okay, so that's capability building block one. What is capability two? Battlefield use of nuclear weapons requires lots of weapons. Tanks are very hard, and destroying them even with nuclear weapons is very difficult. They are much more difficult to destroy than civilian structures. Ashley Tellis, as has been mentioned previously, has this sort of old 2001 book about India's nuclear program, nicely all available on the RAND website, and it takes about 20 PDFs because the book is so long. And for those of us that do South Asia nuclear studies, it's sort of like our Bible. It's, you know, it's long, it's dense. We Talmudically dissect its insights. We look at footnotes. Graduate students are maybe the last people in the world to look at footnotes. And Ashley concluded in 2001 that it might take something like 37 15 kiloton devices, arguably what the size of the Pakistani nuclear weapon, maybe 57 weapons at the 8 kiloton yield, to operationally disable an Indian armored division. Not hard kill of the tanks, but basically kill the soldiers that need to operate the tanks. And this led Ashley to conclude that such a Pakistani effort was unlikely and need not be a serious factor for Indian decision makers as they decided how to destructure their arsenal at the turn of the century. The thing is, Pakistan has taken fissile material production very seriously. According to the best available public estimates, they are making fissile material like it is going out of style. And it kind of is going out of style because we keep on having to say that Pakistan has the fastest growing stockpile of fissile material on the planet. Now, open source estimates of fissile material production require you to guess a lot of things. How is their uranium mining going? How is their enrichment capacity with centrifuges? How big are their reactors? How often are they operational? How much can they reprocess? How big are their warheads? So that's a lot of variables for me to make a guess at. You make a good guess. You have to assign value to those six or seven things. And, you know, you should take it with a shaker of salt. But once you walk through that process and you try to plug in good guesses, you get an estimate that Pakistan could have about 130 to 290 weapons equivalent of fissile material today. And they're on track to produce something, this is going to be a broader range, something between the range of 200 to 600 weapons equivalent by 2020. And you're saying, well, thank you. Thanks for those numbers, MIT guy. I'm so happy you came. And you gave us a huge range, so what's the point? Like 200 to 600, that's 400 weapons. That's like a big difference. But, you know, I think it matters because you could... It's very easy to go from that math to making the conclusion that Pakistan could very well assign 50 warheads to battlefield missions today and still have lots left over for strategic missions. That wasn't true 10 years ago. And certainly in the coming years, Pakistan could devote 50 to 100 weapons to battlefield missions and still have, say, 100 weapons remaining for strategic missions. I think it's difficult to understand the quantity of Pakistani fissile material production absent a desire by them to at least have the capacity to move down a battlefield route. There's just too many of these things for it to make sense for just a counter-value capability. There are other drivers for Pakistani fissile material production. The dominant focus of the force, by far dominant, is to deter India. But they do appear increasingly concerned about U.S. seizure of weapons on Abbottabad against nukes. Now, the thing is that it would be a profoundly foolish venture on the behalf of the United States. Abbottabad was against one well-surveilled target without really any security, and it almost failed, right? One of the helicopters didn't leave. An attempt to go after hundreds of Pakistani nuclear weapons would be orders of magnitude harder, and I would imagine would deter even the most risk-acceptant U.S. president. But it's possible part of the reason Pakistani numbers are so high is fear of the United States. And you have a lot of numbers, you can even deter risk-acceptant U.S. presidents. Additionally, there are hints of Pakistani concern about Indian ballistic missile defenses, as well as Indian conventional and nuclear counterforce capabilities, i.e., the use of conventional or nuclear weapons to target Pakistan's nuclear weapons. To the extent Indian BMD can intercept Pakistani warheads, Pakistan will need more warheads. To the extent Indian forces can find and target Pakistani launch vehicles on the battlefield, Pakistan will need more warheads and delivery vehicles. So there's lots more in the chapter. I review many of the developments on the delivery vehicle side of the house, cruise missiles, moving to the sea, which Pakistan wants to do. I talk in much greater detail about safety and security, something I'm happy to talk about in question and answer. But let me conclude by asking, how does this end? And my sense is that there are two interrelated developments that would arrest the expansion of the Pakistani arsenal. Namely, India-Pakistan relations need to improve. After all, the nuclear expansion is a symptom of the troubled relationship. And or Pakistani resource constraints need to be so severe that a blank check is no longer possible for the strategic nuclear program. Right now, we're just not seeing that. Nawaz Sharif and his foreign affairs advisors are saying all the right things regarding India, but there are lots of spoiler groups out there that seek to stymie that progress. There's some sort of foolishness along the line of control in Kashmir just reported this morning. No one knows really, you know, does Sharif approve? Does the army approve? Who knows? And New Delhi is not in the position to weather lots of provocations at the moment. Manmohan Singh's ability to tell the rest of his government, we're going to proceed with rapprochement, we got elections coming around the corner. Resource constraints are fairly severe with Pakistan, not as bad as they were a few months ago because of international assistance. But so far, the Sharif government has proceeded with budget increases for the military rather than cuts. In particular, even in periods of defense constraint, nuclear weapons may want to be one of the last things that Pakistan cuts. So the arsenal looks like it's going to grow, and nuclear risk will probably grow with it. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks to all of our panelists. Having chaired many panels and also violated rules on my own when I was speaking, they did an excellent job of staying within time. So we have the better part of 20 minutes for questions. So please direct your question either to the panel as a whole or to one individual. Floor is open. Yeah, over here. Please wait for the microphone to come around.
Stanley Rothbard. Try it again. Stanley Roth, Boeing. The question is for Abe, and feel free to decline since you didn't write the chapter on China. But what I'm trying to assess is the growth potential and Chinese intentions on nuclear capability vis-a-vis the United States, with the senator's points about how low can you go, recognizing, as you said, that we have salt with the Russians, and recognizing nascent nature of North Korea and Iran, very troubling regionally, but not necessarily in terms of threat against the U.S. directly, really comes down to China right now. And so given what they're doing with regard to mobility, with regard to increased numbers, possible development towards their own, triad or at least multiple delivery systems, what kind of numbers do you see, which might help give us an assessment of how low we can go?
Thank you, Stanley. I'd be happy to answer the question, but just with the caveat that this is now my opinion and no longer Jeffrey's. China does seem to be very active in its efforts to mobilize its strategic forces, enhancing its mobility, as you mentioned, with more road mobile capabilities, enhancing the effectiveness of its missiles with the DF-41, enhancing the survivability of its missiles primarily through the development of a sea-based deterrent. This, I think, is the way they talk about it, is seen as a response to improving U.S. capabilities in terms of conventional precision strike and missile defense. Wanting to make sure that they have, the way they talk about it is to make sure that they have the ability to retaliate. And concerns that the United States would be able to use conventional forces to negate a retaliatory capability without crossing the nuclear threshold being one of the main things, and the other, that missile defense would be able to blunt any sort of retaliation. In a large sense, a lot of the Chinese scholars that I talk to, a lot of the Chinese officials that I talk to tend to inflate their concerns about the capabilities of American missile defense and precision strike. But although I think that military planners necessarily being pessimists, this is at least an understandable take on their hand, on their part. I do think that they will, the numbers of deployed capabilities may increase a bit, but not substantially. There is very little interest on the Chinese side for a race to parity with the United States. They don't really see any advantage into having parity with the United States. There's a lot of external experts, primarily in the United States, who think that China's ability to rapidly expand its strategic forces would be very difficult for them to hide, so it would be something that we'd be able to see. We expect we would be able to see coming. It does not, more broadly, does not really fit in with their approach to nuclear weapons, to deterrence, that they see that having a sufficient capability to reliably retaliate, to reliably exact costs for a nuclear strike is sufficient enough of a capability. So when you ask them about nuclear arms reductions, New START, and signing on to those things, when you asked how low can we go, the universal reaction that I've had from Chinese people has been, you're not there yet for us to really be part of the discussion. That you're talking about 1,500, getting below 1,500, that China is somewhere in between 200 and 400. So, you know, something like, you know, when you get to 600, give us a call and maybe we can talk then. But broadly speaking, what's driving their capability, what's driving their investments is their concerns that they want to make sure that their capabilities remain survivable and credible in the face of what they see as a more conventional, enhanced conventional capability from the U.S.
Thank you. Also over here and then in the back.
Stanley Kober. I'm looking at an article that appeared a year ago in a Pakistani newspaper, the Express Tribune. Inter-services intelligence reportedly intercepted a telephone call from the TTP, that is the Pakistani Taliban, wherein they were said to have been finalizing their strategy for attacks on nuclear installations. Vehicles carrying suicide bombers would attack these facilities. That this would appear in a Pakistani newspaper, I regard as very striking. And we know that they've had attacks on their own facilities. Security forces have been infiltrated. And I'm wondering if the panel could discuss this threat.
Thank you. Chris, you want to take it first?
I mean, I think it's obvious, and I mean, I think actually the abstract for my chapter says Pakistan remains one of the most likely sources of nuclear risk globally, and that's because you can imagine pretty easy scenarios for use in conflict in South Asia in ways that are more difficult in other areas of the globe for nuclear weapons, and it's also because Pakistan has a lot of troublesome, violent actors that exist within it. It almost certainly has, by any measure, the worst terrorist threat environment of any nuclear state that's ever existed. That's not great. That's bad. There have been high-profile attacks. Attacks against General Headquarters building in Rawalpindi in 2009. Attacks against the Moran Naval Base in 2011. Attacks against the Kamra Air Base in 2012. That's not good. Some of those attacks seem like they have insiders involved. Islamic militants groups have been found trying to infiltrate the Pakistani army. The Pakistani army has caught them. It's always an interesting question when they capture somebody that is trying to infiltrate the army. Does it make you feel good because they caught him, or does it make you feel bad because the attempt was being made? You know, the U.S. has had its own problems with personnel reliability in recent weeks, so I don't know. I don't know how that nets out. I think it is very clear that the Pakistanis take this incredibly seriously. They now have a force between 20,000 and 28,000 personnel that are charged with safeguarding the arsenal. Those personnel are trained. They're trained in part with consultation and training with the United States. They have put forward a number of procedural safeguards. Some of those were a result of the Aku Khan episode. Some of those were a result of these crazy Pakistani nuclear physicists, Majid Mahmood, which we brought to their attention after 9/11, who had been talking to Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. So I don't know how it nets out. They try really, really hard, but they have a very difficult threat environment. And it's not like we can wish them away. We have to keep on telling them to try hard. We keep on having to try to identify those threats ourselves. But, you know, it's, I think you, analytically, Pakistan, Russia still has a lot of material around, though we've spent a lot of effort safeguarding it. North Korea, I think you could have a real debate about what's, if you were to say, what's the most likely source of mushroom cloud on the planet. It's got to be those three states. And that's not good. But that's the reality we have to live with.
Anybody else want to take it or comment on that?
Well, well, related to what Chris said, I mean, I agree, but the other thing is that Pakistan has made a fundamental commitment to outsourcing a large part of its security policy to non-state actors, and it is in bed with Islamic fundamentalist actors, and this is well known. And unless Pakistan gets off that, stops riding the tiger, you know, I mean, it's difficult to stop riding a tiger anyways, but unless Pakistan makes a fundamental strategic decision, this problem will remain a perennial one. And I think the greatest threat in South Asia and to the United States.
Thank you. In the back, please.
Eric Wei, intern at the Arms Control Association. And my question is for Mr. Kampani. India has indicated that with the Agni 5 tests, that five total tests would are the necessary amount of tests before the missile becomes operational. I'm curious to think, to ask is, how realistic is this number in terms of making the missile operational? And then and the second question is how serious is India taking the Agni 5? At 5,000 kilometers, it's a little bit short of ICBM. Is it just a test bed for the Agni 6, or is there a serious consideration of making Agni 5 an operational deterrent in terms of India's strategic calculations?
Well, thank you. This is an interesting question. I mean, so in the case of India's land-based ballistic missiles, there are enormous concerns about operational reliability, and these missiles have a high failure rate, which is getting better as more and more tests are conducted. There is a debate inside the Indian establishment. India's Strategic Forces Command wants more actual full-fledged field tests to improve the reliability of these systems. India's research and development agencies prefer simulations and the testing of components. I do not think, I'm not an engineer, but talking to folks in the Strategic Forces Command, they do not believe that five tests are sufficient for operational reliability. Even in the case of the older missiles, the Strategic Forces Command has only begun over the last 2 years to test these missiles in an operational mode. So this remains the Achilles heel of India's nuclear arsenal, and it will take a lot more for the arsenal to come up to speed. On your second question, how seriously does is India taking the Agni 5? It's actually it's hard to tell because the Defense Research and Development Organization, the development agency, is the only source for information, and there's a lot of contradictory information. So I guess we'll have to watch the events to see what unfolds on the ground to parse the statements. As far as I understand, it was the Agni 4 that was to be a test bed for the Agni 5 and the Agni 6. So I'm still not very clear. It's not very clear.
I would just add, you know, how much reliability do you need, right? If, like, you're sitting in Beijing, you're like, well, I think there's only a 35% chance each Agni will get here. You know, let's still throw a few Agnis your way. One of them might make it. So, you know, I don't know how, you know, we wanted a very high level of reliability in the Cold War. We might have gotten a little crazy with it. So it seems like the levels of the weapons that need to move about in Asia to scare people is a lot less. And, yeah, it's easier to get operational capabilities there.
Thank you. Question here? I'm sorry, right here.
Thank you. I'm John Hanley, just an interested citizen these days. But the question is, India takes its nuclear weapons to sea. Could you expand on what their doctrine or their thinking on that? And then for the rest of the panel, the regional fallout, what likely reactions should we expect from that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
What are their India's ideas for use of their SSBN? For instance, I mean, the various countries have tried to protect them, send them out with groups, protection groups. Where do you think they'll be operating? How will they be protected? How will they be perceived by the other countries around? And what are they likely to do once India goes to sea with an SSBN.
Okay, so so India forces is developing both nuclear, you know, has leased a nuclear attack submarine from Russia and is also developing SSBNs. The SSBN strategy simply is a classic secure second strike capability. It's still about 10 years away. The current S-2 submarine, you know, it deploys a very short range missile. First of all, the missiles have not only been tested from underwater pontoons. They've not even been deployed in the submarine. It's only begun sea trials. So the missile range, as far as I understand, is about 700 to about 1,000 kilometers. Again, there's a lot of obfuscation on the details. So it will, you know, and as with a carrier task force, a nuclear submarine force takes a long time to develop. So the current focus in India is simply to kind of develop the industrial, the basic naval infrastructure to be able to kind of field an SSBN force and a nuclear attack submarine force in the next 2 decades. I think it will take at least another. The current submarine is the S-2, and its successive vehicles are the S-3, S-4, and S-5. There's a debate in the Indian establishment to simply leapfrog and dump the other vehicles and go for a dedicated larger vehicle with a larger reactor capable of fielding medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles. But that's a long-term approach. So this is more of a technology demonstrator project at this point. The implications will unfold, I think, over the next 15 years.
You want to do Pakistan?
Yeah. Pakistan has expressed interest in developing a naval nuclear-capable cruise missile. There is this sort of pattern. Sometimes India will announce a capability. It'll take a long time to develop it, and its neighbors will react to the capability it said it's going to have, and then India doesn't get the capability for a few decades. So it's a little bad. There's this check-cashing problem Bipin Narang sort of talks about often. I would just flag another issue, which is true in both India and Pakistan. For a long time, and maybe still today, we thought that both India and Pakistan kept their weapons demated during peacetime, so warheads separated from delivery vehicles. It's very tough to do that with underwater nuclear missiles, whether cruise or ballistic. There may be ways, there may be operational ways you could do it at sea, but that's not a great place to be doing those sorts of things. So there are reasons to think that maybe both India and Pakistan have moved away from demating in the last 5 years. DRDO chiefs have said things about very quick Indian reaction times, which led Bipin Narang, I think Gaurav is in a different place on this, to conclude that maybe India has kept some portion of the force mated during peacetime. So a naval portion of the Indian force might be demated, it might be mated during peacetime, or they might choose to only send the sub out to sea during crisis. That creates some first strike incentives, maybe less worrisome in South Asia than they were in the Cold War. Pakistan would have those same challenges. Khalid Kidwai has said things in the last 5 years that make it sound like Pakistan might also be moving away from demating. It's very tough to know in the open sources. And my guess is Pakistani decision makers might be willing to accept a different level of nuclear risk than Indian decision makers in terms of nukes at sea. But, you know, it's very possible that you could have lots of countries sailing around the Indian Ocean with nuclear weapons, in part because I hear from naval officers that work in the region, the nature of the Indian Ocean, inversion layers, ocean currents, very tough to do anti-submarine warfare. So though the range of these weapons means that, you know, a Pakistani maritime nuke is probably still going to be focused on India's west and south, probably not the east. And then India has this big challenge that, you know, China's east coast is a long way away. That's a long way to send your sub. But, you know, you got to have the technology demonstrator. DRDO's got to do something in the morning.
Yeah, in terms of China, I don't think the prospect of an Indian sea-based deterrent is keeping the Chinese up at night too much. On one hand, they don't really like to talk about India in this context. From the folks that I've talked to, they feel it kind of brings them down a peg in the global geopolitics of things. They prefer to talk about the U.S. and great power stuff. But that being said, China has been replacing some of its older liquid-fueled missiles with more advanced solid DF-21s. Some DF-21s have been deployed to Qinghai province, and there's some DF-31s in central China, both of which could cover major strategic targets in India. And more importantly, I think is that China prefers to threaten India by proxy anyway, which also complicates the nuclear dynamic there. For what it's worth, though, China is also very unsure, at least from everything that's been said publicly, written publicly, about how their sea-based deterrent, once it becomes operational, would be used. A lot of the same issues that Chris mentioned, unclear if they would prefer a bastion strategy either in the Bohai, the South China Sea, or a more U.S.-style deployment and patrol into the Western Pacific or South China Sea. It's very unclear which they prefer. And there's also the question of mating the warheads and the missiles, which they tend to not do, and who would control once it's on board. There was a few years ago, there was discussion of a bit of a controversy inside the PLA, some discussion that the 2nd Artillery Corps wanted to have a 2nd Artillery Corps guy on the submarine who would, you know, be part of the decision to whether or not to use it, whereas the Navy just obviously didn't want to have it do that, and just the standard Hunt for Red October, political commissar, captain, turn the key thing. I've been hearing rumors in the last few years that the Navy may have won that battle, and there may be just a Navy decision chain, at least on the submarine, without 2nd Artillery Corps getting involved. But again, that's all rumor and innuendo and from folks like me who talk amongst ourselves about it. And I haven't seen anything official about any of that on the Chinese side.
Great, thank you. We are actually out of time, but I'm going to take one more question over here. And then I ask for a short question and short answers, and we'll wrap up this session.
I wanted to appreciate Dr. Gampani's mention of Indian BMD and the bucketful assault, and tying that to Chris's comments on taking India writing checks it perhaps cannot cash. And to ask you if you could talk a little bit about India and the move towards battlefield or tactical or whatever term one wants to use for weapons that would be in the same sort of category as the Nusser. Again, we have DRDO comments that get Pakistanis quite riled up, and many Pakistanis assume India already has a BMD system. So where do you see India going in the tactical battlefield arena?
There has been some pressure from the military to respond to Pakistan's development of tactical nuclear weapons, actually. But at the political level, that authorization does not seem to be forthcoming. But India has, you know, as I said, simple fission warheads are the war horses of India's arsenal, and they can be used perfectly well in tactical battlefield settings. The Strategic Forces Command has thought through how it might be used. There is, as I said, massive retaliation is a rhetorical device, and the Indian military, if it does respond, will respond at a tactical level if there is, tactical use in the case of Pakistan. And there are a variety of scenarios. But I don't think they have tactical nuclear weapons per se. But this is, again, they may, you know, for example, India developed chemical weapons and nobody knew, and the Indian military never knew about them. Maybe they have, weapons. But in this sense, because institutionally the Strategic Forces Command and the armed services are separated, the Indians are very adamant that there's nothing as tactical nuclear weapons use. It opens a whole can of worms. It will force sort of integration of the nuclear and the conventional arms, and they'd best keep it separate. But if the push came to a shove, they might use their fission weapons in a tactical way.
I would just add, it's not probably great that DRDO decided to announce it's going to develop a very short-range ballistic missile system, the Prahar, you know, shortly after the Nasser test. I mean, you don't need to ever, you know, in every capability Pakistan fields, you don't need your own capability. India already had Smirch multi-barrel rocket launch systems. I can understand the need for some sort of long-range rocket artillery like the U.S. ATACMS system, but it sometimes seems like the DRDO can speak without anybody in the MEA or the PMO telling them whether it's a good idea or not, and that may not be a desirable state of affairs for the world or South Asian stability.
And can I just add, just because the DRDO says something doesn't mean it's going to be operationally developed. It might be given a certain amount of money to test and play with something, but you perhaps will not see an operational system.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank the audience for really outstanding questions and ask you to thank the panel for really good presentations and answers to their questions.
Thank you. That's very good. It's a real privilege and honor to be invited to chair this distinguished panel. My name is Travis Tanner. I currently work for the 100,000 Strong Foundation, but until very recently was the Strategic Asia Program Director at NBR for a number of years, and so it's wonderful to still be considered part of the NBR family, so I'm grateful for that. I'd like to just briefly thank Ashley Tellis, who will be taking the podium here shortly, for the wonderful leadership that he's offered and for the opportunity it's been for me and the really distinct professional honor to work with him on the last five editions of Strategic Asia, of the 10 that he's edited that Rich alluded to earlier. He's truly a mentor to me. I'd like to thank all of the authors that worked so diligently this year on the book. Obviously, without them, the volume would not be the quality product that it is. They've done a wonderful job. And then lastly, thank Rich Ellings, Abe Denmark, Josh Nemzowski, as well as Greg Chafin and the rest of the NBR team that did so much to bring the book into fruition. It wouldn't have happened without them. So just to take one step backward, the goal of this year's book was to analyze the role of nuclear weapons in the grand strategies of several key Asian states, and then additionally to increase understanding of the impact of nuclear capabilities of a variety of Asian nations and the impact on the regional and international relations. We did the book, as you've noted from the schedule and from the breakdown of panels, is broken down into three sections. The first looking at acknowledged nuclear powers, the second looking at latent nuclear capabilities, states with latent nuclear capabilities, the focus of our panel here today, and then third will be our final panel looking at the special study that was produced looking at U.S. extended deterrence in Asia, which will be also a wonderful panel to participate in. So the authors that I have here with me on the stage were asked to do three kind of main tasks. I just wanted to overview those before they kick off their presentations. And the first was to look at the nature of latency in their respective countries' resident national capabilities in the areas of infrastructure, fissile materials, advanced computation, delivery systems, the R&D infrastructure, and human capital in the nuclear realm. Second, we asked them to look at the external and the domestic political, strategic, economic, technological factors that could prompt a potential nuclear power to transform its latent capacity into actual nuclear weapons program. And then third, to assess the impact on the regional and global system of a decision by a particular country to go nuclear. So not an easy task. They've done a marvelous job at taking a real solid swing at this set of requests, and I think they've done a marvelous job. So it's been a very interesting exercise, and we're going to turn the time over to them now. So I will briefly introduce our distinguished panel. You have their bios in the materials that were handed out earlier. We'll ask John Park first to speak. John is an associate at the Project on Managing the Atom at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. We also have Robert Reardon, who is a research fellow at the Project on Managing the Atom, as well as the International Security Program at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center on Science and International Affairs. And then we have James Schaff, who is a senior research associate in the Asian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So we'll go ahead and ask John to kick things off.
Great. Thank you very much. Just wanted to echo Travis's warm remarks and thanks to MBR for putting this together. And it was a rewarding experience to be a part of the team, and certainly a very important case study in terms of how to shepherd an edited volume. The three things I wanted to do in my remarks for the 10 minutes, first is to give an overview of the chapter, and then the second to zero in on the aspects pertaining to deterrence, and the third to focus on diagnosis. If there's a unifying theme to the chapter itself, is the idea of trying to apply the medical analogy of the three stages of treatment. The first is diagnosis. The second is trying to come up with a treatment protocol. And the third is monitoring the situation. If you ask medical professionals, about 70% of the time is focused on diagnosis. You're trying to figure out what the causes are here. You're developing hypotheses, running tests. Based on that, you move to the next stage of a treatment protocol, what can effectively address the causes. And the third, with all complex situations, looking at the side complications and monitoring, and if required, go back to diagnosis. My observation in my limited time in Washington is that if you applied this to policymakers, usually the first stage that they go into is the second stage treatment, and about 90% of the time is focused on that. Usually it's intuitive in terms of a carrot or a stick. Usually it's a crisis moment, so certainly a lot of sympathy for policymakers in this environment. And usually when things don't go according to plans, that's where they do retroactively the diagnosis and try to figure out. That's where the experts are called in. You do trips to the region and so forth. Now, the remaining time, you're looking at some aspect of monitoring. Applying this to North Korea has been helpful for me, and I'll mention the last part, some of the points that came out in terms of my research looking at this diagnosis aspect. But the first part, overview, the objective that I laid out was to explore North Korea's evolving use, and it is very much an evolution of its nuclear arsenal and implications for both the Korean Peninsula and U.S. policy. Within this, North Korea's nuclear weapons program has evolved to encompass a lot of different uses. I think it's not an either-or proposition when you look at the results. Motivations, intentions, enormously difficult to gauge. Even if you capture it, it's a moment in time because they shift so much. But if you focus on the outcomes and try to read the patterns, the three things that come out for me, one is the regime's use of its nuclear weapons program to deter its adversaries. This is something where North Korea, with a dilapidated conventional force, although numerically superior to their adversaries in the region, clearly it is a deteriorating type of force. And so this deterring with nuclear weapons seems to be very compelling in terms of their constitution now and a lot of their policy statements. The second is generating revenue. This is something that is forgotten largely, but in a recent past, North Korea was in a nuclear cooperation deal with Syria. It all led to an Israeli surgical strike on the facility in Syria in September of 2007. So this isn't in the realm of speculation. This is something in terms of development and cooperation that was well documented. In the years coming, other researchers, I think this would be a very fascinating topic for a thesis of some kind for more detail about the causal mechanisms there. The third use was in terms of, and here I'm venturing a little off of what you may traditionally read about the North Korean nuclear weapons program, but in terms of pattern recognition, it looks like the North Koreans are putting together a North Korean version of Eisenhower's New Look policy. What was the New Look policy? After the Second World War, with massive allocations to the military and the thought of how to maintain a strong deterrent stand in the United States, but do it in a very cost-efficient manner and focus on the rebuilding of the American economy, the idea was to nuclearize key components of the U.S. military arsenal. And with that, you saw the effort to do this in peacetime in an effort where it was catch-up. The priority was resources to the war effort. In a short period of time, the idea was to revitalize the U.S. economy. In a North Korean sense, the one benefit really is that because of different motivations earlier on, the outcome of those motivations resulted in North Korea devoting enormous amount of resources to the early parts of its nuclear weapons program. So in financial terms, that's a sunk cost. They've already devoted a lot to it. While they have continued with their activities, the activities compared to the scale of the earlier period, it really is something where I wouldn't say it's a great return on investment, but there is something that resembles that. And so as they make forward movement in their nuclear weapons program, there are internal priorities as well. It's a dilapidated economy. Any notion of economic reform is truly academic because there is no basic transportation or electricity infrastructure in North Korea. And so this putting your eggs in the nuclear basket has different semblances of a new look. And this also frees up resources. And I'll talk a little bit about the internal power consolidation going on in North Korea and how this type of policy might fit into an idea of a structure for reallocating resources away from the military into the domestic economy. So the implications, just to quickly sum up here, the latent nuclear capabilities in the region really relate to South Korea and Japan. I'll save the Japan part for my colleague Jim Schaff. But looking at the South Korean piece, the context is very important. There have been previous academic studies. There have been analyses of different public opinions in South Korea. But the context is crucial. When those statements and when those attitudes were expressed, it was a very much a different time period. And as much as on the surface it would seem to be nuclear related, in many respects, it ties to a big wake-up call and shock for South Korea. And those were the two North Korean attacks against South Korea in 2010. This whole notion that deterrence might have failed is something that clearly won't be discussed publicly, but a lot of the internal studies and discussions focus on what's the point of having a superior conventional conventional force here if North Korea can conduct two provocations and get away with it. So the nuclear context is being revisited through the lens of how do you prevent North Korea's continued attacks in this particular area. The second implication is for the United States in preserving regional stability and security. It's no longer a function of just reassuring the allies. Now I think if you look at that reassuring component, it is a necessary, but it's not a sufficient element. What is critical now is disrupting North Korean procurement channels. North Korea has made rapid and startling improvements in its nuclear and missile capabilities. So this whole question of how has it been able to do that, I think is a very important component. I'll mention that in the latter part in the diagnosis phase. Very quickly to talk about the deterrence aspect, I won't go too much on the nuclear factor. It's in the chapter, but something that is a bit different to highlight and give you a little bit of background, what sounds might sound a little fantastic, but it's Beijing's sunshine policy with Chinese characteristics. There are a lot of things that the Chinese government, particularly the Communist Party of China, is doing vis-a-vis the Workers' Party of Korea and North Korea that has very important implications for all of us. One part that is crucial here is the long shadow of South Korea's northern policy. When South Korea normalized relations with China in 1992, it set into motion the fraying and some would argue the lost decade in North Korea relations through the party-to-party mechanism, to the point where the Chinese really try to build up that relationship as a longer-term part of a stable environment in the region. And that seems to be a big factor in terms of what the Communist Party of China is doing vis-a-vis the North Koreans. But this ties into a contradiction, this clearly unintended consequence, but the contradiction for the CPC is the fact that they are the chair of the six-party talks. They are serious about denuclearization. They want to see denuclearization in the condition of peaceful negotiations and the product of a deal, as opposed to by force or coercion. But at the same time, they're engaged in this party-to-party mechanism because of this view that North Korea is such an unstable variable, and now they have the means and the certain type of capabilities they didn't have before that they can apply to this particular issue. For North Korea, that creates a lot of space. And the space here, to me, that's defined as the CPC giving to the Workers' Party of Korea an RSA. We've heard of NSA, PSA. RSA, to me, is regime security assurance. And the institution that is going on between the two parties is not a product of new found alliance or anything related to going back to Cold War ideology. It is the party-party mechanism using a lot of commercial capitalist means to shore up this fragile regime in Pyongyang. Let me quickly move to the diagnosis part in the time remaining and highlight four key points. One is the primary tool that is being used, not only by the United States, by the international community, trying to shape the environment and inform North Korea's decision-making and how it will deal with nuclear weapons and guide it towards disarmament, are sanctions. But sanctions are a trickle in terms of what are being caught up in the web. Compared to the tidal wave of Chinese-North Korean trade. In 2011, the bilateral trade was estimated to be about $6 billion. A lot of analysts view that as underreported because China is very sensitive to being seen as propping up this pariah regime. But with this, very recently we had the Chinese Ministry of Commerce issue a 236-page report listing nuclear and missile components that fall under this category of dual use. But in practice, if you look at the commercial activities between North Korea and China, that has now become a catalog for priceless. Prices have gone up for these components, which means that you'll have some very creative and, I think, influential and effective Chinese middlemen coming out to do some of the procurement on behalf of North Korean entities. So this is a regime, if you think of it as an organism, evolving and mutating to our detriment. The second point I wanted to highlight is that in the analysis, it becomes very clear that North Korea is not a country. So I think we have to move away from national statistics and national means of gauging the economy, the military, and so forth. In practice, North Korea, there are two North Koreas. The 1% encompasses the elites. They basically maintain their position by running North Korean state trading companies. They generate revenue for themselves. It's funneled to the military. The Kim family assigns concessions to very powerful members in the elites. That type of mechanism is crucial to understanding, I think, the contradiction of the prosperity in Pyongyang right now. For recent visitors noted how the average conspicuous consumption symbols have been increasing quite dramatically in Pyongyang. There are now signs of obesity as almost an epidemic in Pyongyang. This is counter to this view of a starving nation on its last legs. But of course, then there's a 99%. And the 99% are left to their own devices with informal markets, greater access to regional connections at the lower level, but makes it very difficult to diagnose if you don't account for this divergence between the 1% and the 99%. So the third point here is that the Communist Party of China's policy of peace and stability puts a restraining factor on both Koreas, and we saw this play out in 2010. China was very adamant about preventing an escalation to crisis. So you had State Councilor Dai Bing-guo at that time engage in Chinese shuttle diplomacy, go to Seoul and Pyongyang, and literally tear apart the two potential combatants. For South Korea, in terms of its conventional deterrent capability, China now is being seen as the one that would be the buffer to prevent, in many cases, South Korea from responding. I think this sends a signal to North Korea that they can launch provocations against South Korea and get away with it. So the situation is getting very dangerous in the conventional side of things, as much as the headlines capture the nuclear. So there are two factors, but of the two, I would prioritize the conventional. And then the final point, to wrap this all up with a very specific message, if you look at the different spaces, the unintended consequences of priorities from the Chinese side, the different actions of the North Koreans clearly are not interested in nuclear disarmament, but they are interested in nuclear arms control negotiations. And embedded in that is this idea of a minimal nuclear deterrent. They can give away, negotiate away the Yongbyon facilities and so forth. But that is clearly something that we're not prepared in any circumstance to entertain seriously. But the writing, I think, is becoming clearer and clearer in terms of that kind of signaling. From a different analyst perspective, if you look at the early phases of what's embedded in the September 2005 agreement, some would argue that that in practice looks like nuclear arms control. But the idea that later on you would work towards disablement, disarmament. So this could be for some a definitional thing, but clearly for countries like the United States and South Korea, this is something that would not be entertained at all.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. Robert?
Well, thanks, everybody, for being here. And I'd also like to thank the staff at NBR for the fantastic job that they did putting this together. It was a great opportunity. Enjoyed being part of the project. So just to quickly go over some of the findings of the chapter and then hopefully be able to get into a little more depth with this in the Q&A. First, to outline the main argument of the chapter on Iran, the first part has to do with the nature of Iran's nuclear latency or its nuclear capabilities. And I argue that debates over whether or not Iran has a nuclear capability or when it will develop a nuclear capability obscures the fact that Iran already has or likely has the technical wherewithal to put together a nuclear weapon. The term nuclear capability itself is a very slippery and ambiguous one. There are almost certainly technical challenges that Iran would have to overcome to assembling a nuclear weapon, but this would pale in comparison to both the technical challenges that it has already overcome in its program and the strategic and political challenges that form a barrier to acquiring nuclear weapons. And I think that that's really the key point, that much more than technical capabilities, what determines whether or not Iran will proceed to nuclear weapons has to do more with strategic considerations, political considerations, and which brings me to my second point, what exactly drives Iran's decision-making, its nuclear decision-making? What are its interests? What are its intentions? And I outline three dimensions along which these considerations are made. One is regime security. Another is prestige and influence, both domestically for the regime and internationally. And third, the particular interests of domestic political actors. So to briefly talk about these three, first, it's a very complex calculus in Iran, what the costs and benefits are of any particular choice of action. And in many respects, it depends on who's going to be in charge of making the decisions and how the decision makers perceive whether or not any particular step is going to enhance enhance their standing in these three categories. For example, in many respects, Iran reaps as much of a benefit relative to costs from approaching but remaining below the nuclear threshold as it would from actually trying to acquire nuclear weapons. For one thing, right now Iran has to be concerned. Iran is deterred from crossing certain lines. It has to be concerned that any attempt at a breakout could trigger preventive military force against Iran. Iran is reaping certain benefits from being able to maintain a narrative that it is a victim of the West, that the West is leveraging its ability to manipulate the IAEA and the UN Security Council for its own interests, and they are trying to deny Iran what it portrays as peaceful civilian technologies to which it has a legitimate right. I think that we underestimate the degree to which this narrative actually resonates internationally, and we often like to portray Iran as a pariah state, as if it were similar to North Korea in that regard, and the fact is that it's not. Iran's appeal to the outside world and its connections to the outside world are considerably greater than states like North Korea. And there is ample evidence that Iran's particular claims regarding the nuclear dispute do find an audience both in the region and globally, particularly among the non-aligned states. In terms of the particular interests of domestic actors, I'd like to focus in particular on the results of the recent election of President Rouhani and how that might affect Iran's bargaining posture. I'd like to say first that in terms of the fundamentals of Iran's bargaining position, every indication so far is that this isn't going to substantially change, at least not in any big way. In other words, Iran has been consistent in its insistence that it is going to continue to enrich uranium, it is going to continue to maintain a civilian nuclear program, it is not going to suspend, and certainly not going to give up that program, regardless of sanctions or threats. And I don't see any indication that that is going to shift. In fact, the opposite. The other is that Iran is appears very interested in getting out from under sanctions, that sanctions have imposed a great deal of economic pain on the country, and I think that this is a particular goal of the Rouhani government, not least because the Rouhani government's claim to legitimacy was that Ahmadinejad and his government had failed, that it was under Ahmadinejad that most of these sanctions came into place, that Ahmadinejad is blamed for the country's economic woes, and that Rouhani's promise is that he's going to successfully address this. And this does two things. One, it creates an opportunity for the United States and its partners because it's dealing with a government that does have a greater willingness, perhaps, to make some concessions in return for some lifting of sanctions. On the other hand, there's a window of opportunity here that could rapidly close because if Rouhani isn't capable of bringing back something tangible to Tehran, some tangible concession from the West, particularly some lifting of sanctions in or relief from sanctions in a serious way, which has not been offered yet by the P5+1, then this is going to fuel the criticism of hardliners. Right now, the position of hardliners in Tehran seems to be substantially weakened, but they're not out of the game. The Supreme Leader appears to have given Rouhani quite a bit of leeway, perhaps himself believing that it is imperative that Iran gets out from under sanctions and seeing this as a way to do it. But this is only going to last so long. Khamenei is certainly not going to go down with Rouhani if he's seen as a failure in this regard. So I think that if Rouhani isn't given something that he can demonstrate success with in Tehran, this could be successfully seized upon by hardliners, and this creates a lot of time pressure in which to find some sort of negotiated settlement. The other thing that I'd like to point to is what implications all of this has for the region. So just to outline a few different scenarios, because the implications for the region are heavily dependent on how this turns out. So one that I'd like to highlight is the potential for airstrikes or the use of military force against Iran. So we're in a period right now where this is downplayed in the West. We're not in the same situation as we were in, say, December 2010, when the rhetoric was rapidly closing window of opportunity, zones of immunity, points of no return, and a big push for airstrikes. But I think that if we don't see results in the diplomacy front soon, we're very likely to return to that. And so I think it's worth addressing. I argue in the chapter that there's a strong possibility that the use of airstrikes not only overall could make the situation worse, but could paradoxically make it more likely for Iran to develop nuclear weapons, or lead to Iran developing nuclear weapons sooner than it otherwise would. And the thinking goes something like this. At least right now, Iran appears content to gradually improve its breakout capacity. In other words, there's absolutely no indication that Iran is making some sort of hell-bent dash toward a nuclear weapon, quite the opposite. And there are a number of checks in place, for example, IAEA safeguards, that seem to deter Iran, or at least give it a strong incentive to slow its development of its nuclear capabilities. Airstrikes very likely is not going to permanently deny Iran the capability of developing nuclear weapons, and probably wouldn't set it back for more than 4 or 5 years, maybe slightly more at the most. I mean, if you consider the time it's taken them to develop it from scratch, you're probably not going to get something like a 10-year delay. And on top of that, you can expect that Iran is going to withdraw from the NPT. You're not going to have IAEA inspectors on the ground. It's possible that the United States wouldn't be able to maintain the sanctions regime, wouldn't be able to maintain the support of the Chinese and the Russians as it has, giving Iran more of an opportunity and much more of an incentive to develop nuclear weapons. I think a better way to look at this is that Iran has a sophisticated nuclear capability now, that its nuclear choices are based more on its interests and intentions than on its technical base, that right now Iran has many incentives to either make a deal or at a minimum to maintain its nuclear capabilities but remain below the threshold of actually producing weapons, and that airstrikes could actually upset that and lead Iran to go after nuclear weapons more than ever. At the same time, it is highly unlikely that there is anything that the United States can do short of regime change that is going to permanently prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Airstrikes, it's unlikely, is going to do that. So quickly, are we going to get some sort of negotiated settlement? I have to say I'm not entirely optimistic, although I have some hope. I pointed out that I don't think that the fundamental bargaining positions here have changed. I think that in order to get some agreement, Iran is going to have to be left with some sort of uranium enrichment program. We could quibble about what that might entail and what sort of limitations on that they might accept. But at an absolute minimum, they're going to be enriching up to 5%. They're going to be enriching at Natanz. There's been indications that they might agree to freeze the production of 20%, but they're going to have to maintain at least some sort of enrichment capability. At the same time, they're going to have to see some sort of real sanctions relief. In the United States, I think that both of these things are extremely difficult to deliver. For one thing, many of the sanctions depend upon a vote in Congress in order to be lifted. I don't need to argue why it would be difficult to get such a vote successfully. So the president has some, but nonetheless limited leeway in what sort of sanctions relief he can deliver. One possibility is that the Europeans could make concessions with oil sanctions, but in terms of many of the sanctions, I think it would be difficult to get buy-in from Congress. Also, I think that, again, for domestic political reasons in the United States, it would be very difficult for the administration to agree to anything that left Iran with a substantial enrichment program in place. I think particularly that this would be difficult in the near term. And if it's true that we face a closing window of opportunity with the Iranians, this is also a reason for pessimism. So what does this mean? Well, I think that the likeliest outcome here is that we're going to see continued stalemate for quite some time. I think that we'll continue to see the Iranians slowly develop their capabilities. We'll see the United States and its bargaining partners searching for some sort of, at a minimum, confidence-building measure to buy time or to at least lower tensions so that we're not under such time pressures in dealing with the situation. But I don't think that we're going to see substantial movement either towards some sort of military resolution to this, which I don't think is possible, or towards a diplomatic resolution. So I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you, Robert. Jim?
Thanks, Travis. And I too would like to thank NBR and the Elliott School for having us here today and for the opportunity to NBR for the opportunity to be a part of this project. I have a little bit rosier story to tell than the Iran story. And I also really want to thank Richard Dick Samuels up at MIT with whom I collaborated and co-wrote the chapter. It's always a pleasure to work with Dick, and he apologizes for not being able to be here today, so I'll withstand his criticism later when I tell him how I did. I'll start off to summarize our chapter with something that the Japanese defense establishment and foreign ministry often likes to use, which is a double negative. And I'll say our main argument is that it is not accurate to say that Japan will never go nuclear. And our chapter explains why we think this is the case and what implication this has for U.S. policymakers. And because we don't think a Japanese nuclear breakout is any kind of imminent prospect, it's not necessarily a regional implication story as much as it is an alliance implication story and a reassurance story. But there are some important factors that could lead toward a harder hedge in Japan, and these are the areas where we focus heavily. Japan's nuclear hedge is largely unappreciated. It's not a few screwdriver turns away from having a nuclear device, as some suggest, but the political leadership and the government have had a consistent policy for decades to maintain viable options for a relatively rapid acquisition of nuclear weapon capability, primarily to encourage continued strong U.S. Commitment to extended deterrence, but also to be prepared in case the strategic situation changed significantly. The hedge takes the form of a complete nuclear fuel cycle in Japan, including enrichment and reprocessing facilities. And the linkage here has been quite specific, most recently as Japan's nuclear energy program has encountered such dramatic problems. We've had former and even incumbent defense ministers make the argument that the preservation of a nuclear energy industry is important to, quote, allow Japan to produce a nuclear warhead in a short amount of time. Now, despite nuclear energy challenges in Japan, in which at this current moment we have no nuclear reactors operating, Dick and I do assume that this is a temporary phenomena and that Japan's nuclear energy industry will revive to at least some degree. Maybe it will not reach quite the same scale that it had in the past, but it will be robust, barring further incidents in Japan. Still an open prospect. But Japan's hedge also includes opportunities at delivery vehicles, including a solid fuel 1.8-ton payload, three-stage long-range rocket program, the Epsilon, which just recently had its first successful launch, and experiments with reentry technology since 1994. There are many reasons why Japan won't go nuclear anytime soon, including extremely little political support in the country. This is the nuclear allergy that people talk about that is very real, although we argue it's not a genetic condition. And institutional and legal hurdles that some people have called veto players, de facto veto players. And Dick and I argue more that they are obstacles, but not necessarily veto players per se. Still, Japan's non-nuclear bona fides are quite strong and real and robust. So we don't want to create any alarm here. Even if Japanese leadership could convince the public that this was the right way to go for national security reasons, there are many reasons why it wouldn't be quick, including a large gap between the nuclear energy, science, and engineering community and the military establishment. A large gap there that would be hard and take time to bridge. Lack of warhead design experience, no real reliable delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons at this point. And we think that Japan would be the last to go nuclear in Asia, that clearly South Korea would have to go before Japan would, but I don't think it would take very long after that, which is why John's chapter is so important in terms of the debate in South Korea. And it doesn't mean that we can ignore the factors that could drive Japan into this direction, because some of those factors are evident already. Throughout the Cold War, of course, the U.S. extended deterrent was never in doubt in Japan. We were locked in an ideological struggle with an adversary with which we had virtually no economic engagement. And at one point, we had 3,000 nuclear weapons on shore in Asia, throughout the Asia-Pacific, including about 1,200 nuclear weapons in Okinawa. Japan was relatively flexible regarding our transport of these weapons and components at the time, especially after China's nuclear breakout in 1964. So there was a very palpable sense of credibility to the U.S. nuclear umbrella at that time. I would say around 2001, there was certainly increased awareness and focus here in Washington, D.C., about the requirements for reassurance of Japan and Korea regarding our extended deterrence commitments. The Treaty of Moscow promised quite significant reductions in U.S. nuclear stockpile, and we heard questions about this from Japan more so than we had in the past. Part of the reassurance story at the time to Japan was that we were going to retain Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles, nuclear capable, TLAM-N, as something that could be reintroduced if we ever needed it. And in a sense, these were kind of your weapons. We're holding these onto these for you. We promised other aspects of commitment and continuity. Of course, eventually we, by the time we got into the Nuclear Posture Review of 2009-2010, we realized that we were probably going to eliminate that class of weapon system, and there were other things that we wanted to do. And we were quite proactive of engaging Japan and South Korea in consultations and negotiations during the NPR at that time, because of that experience that we had had throughout the early 2000s. So I think that was an extremely important development. Japan and South Korea felt more involved, felt that their opinion mattered, and actually adjusted some of the language in the NPR. Because not only did you have the experience in 2001, but you also had, U.S. stockpile numbers dropped to less than half of the 2001 figure by 2009. And we also had this damaging debate, in a sense, of the reliable replacement warhead, and those that wanted to fund the reliable replacement warhead had to disparage the imminent, the near-term credibility of our deterrent at the time. So that in addition to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the financial crisis, had taken some of the luster out of our sole superpower status. So we overcame that to some extent with continued commitments in the region through this consultation process, and which eventually evolved into something we call the Extended Deterrence Dialogue with Japan and the Extended Deterrence Policy Committee with South Korea. I'll skip over some of the other scary numbers from a Japanese perspective in terms of Chinese military budget growth and North Korea's nuclear tests, of course, in the meantime. All of this feeds into this sense of potential vulnerability and concern about a potential decoupling similar to what we had in the old NATO and European experience. Questions that we get from Japan include, will the U.S. seek to avoid escalation at a potentially high cost to Japan to protect our homeland and other interests? Will the U.S. deterrent be reliable enough? Will it be flexible enough? Will it be prompt enough? These are some of the kinds of conversations that are taking place now that had never taken place in the context of the alliance. And the U.S. has a reassuring story to tell, I think, in this regard, so that those consultations are going relatively well. But there's a point at which just talk doesn't necessarily reassure that it also needs to be backed up by actions. Some of the extended deterrence dialogue meetings include visits by Japanese officials to U.S. nuclear assets and facilities in the United States to visibly see what it is we have, what we're investing, in particular the human capital that's so important. And I think that has a strong reassuring effect. China looms large over the long term for Japan, of course, but I think North Korea is the main threat and the main problem right now. And it's unpredictable and more likely to find itself in an existential threat circumstance. We don't know whether it will view perhaps a demonstrating a nuclear device in some kind of conflict scenario or crisis scenario as being in its own interests. And if so, if that creates some kind of damage vis-a-vis Japan, then how do you respond? What if North Korea tries to isolate Japan in a nuclear context? Do we respond in a nuclear fashion vis-a-vis North Korea? What does South Korea have to say in that regard? So there are a lot of detailed things that we need to have conversations about so that there's increased confidence among us. We also need to be committed to the whole spectrum of alliance cooperation, and the 2+2 meeting going on in Tokyo tomorrow will address some of that. Nothing is more reassuring than our close and comprehensive relationship in all facets, economic and military as well. Because I'm running out of time, I want to talk about one last point, I think, in terms of policy implications for the United States. Obviously, we need to keep funding our government and a reliable nuclear deterrent at some level. It's important to think through what our strategy really is. It's not just an abstract concept. Well, we have these nukes here, and we can use them if we ever need to. We need to begin thinking in more concrete terms about how would they apply in a North Korean situation. How do we consult with allies in this situation? We moved from TLMN to conventional and then talked about dual-capable aircraft. We propped that up as the main savior. Well, what if conventional spending is going down? What if we're actually not going to use dual-capable aircraft in terms of introducing them to the region? Maybe we're just going to send bombers from the U.S. If we keep changing our story about what the nuclear umbrella looks like and how we're prepared to provide it, that undermines this sense of confidence. And I think we need to redouble efforts for North Korean denuclearization, including trilateral cooperation with South Korea, so the Japan-Korea relationship is key in this regard. Sanctions enforcement, but then also an engagement strategy with North Korea that doesn't enrich the regime. And communications with China is also critical in this regard because of Japanese concerns over what we mean by long-term strategic stability with China. Do we mean the same thing we mean with Russia? We don't think so, but we have to go through a process of explaining what that means. But I'll save the rest for questions, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you, Jim. I'll give him a round of applause. Great presentations. I think that's an indication you all agree that our presenters have done a great job of outlining the capabilities, the motivations, the implications of the late nuclear weapons programs of these of their countries. Of a focus, so they've done a great job. It's now your turn to dig a little deeper. We have about approximately 15 or so minutes for questions, so please just identify yourself when you pose your question, and we'll go ahead and proceed from here. I have a couple of questions in the back. Okay.
Hello, my name is Lucia Levac. I'm a graduate student at American University. And I had a question for Mr. Schopf about Japan. You mentioned that Japan would probably be the last to go in Asia to actually get nuclear power. So I was wondering, if they actually were to get nuclear power, how would that change, or nuclear weapons, excuse me, how would that change the U.S. relationship with Japan in that situation if they're the last to go? Is that something the U.S. would prefer, or might that be something that would still deter Japan from wanting to get it, the fear of ruining that relationship?
Thank you. We actually talk about that to some extent in the chapter. And there's the general assumption is that the United States would never approve of Japan going nuclear. And I think certainly in this context that's the case. But if you have a situation where South Korea believes that it needs some level of control over a nuclear capability and therefore moves down that line, that it is conceivable that the U.S. might be willing to support some kind of nuclear, independent nuclear Japanese capability. I mean, we're having that debate right now on a very small scale. In Japan, they're talking about developing some kind of offensive strike capability in the context of defense, of self-defense. But if North Korea was lobbing missiles and missile defense was not enough, should Japan have the ability to join with the United States in a coordinated alliance effort to suppress North Korean missiles? That you could extend that debate and conversation in a much more intense regional security environment to potentially include nuclear weapons. And you could conceive of lease options or other kinds of situations that would be more financially attractive and technologically attractive and politically attractive, whereby Japan has some control over essentially U.S. weapons that are in theater, and after North Korea goes away and there's happy reunion on the Korean Peninsula, those weapons could be returned, and you could essentially then denuclearize quite easily. And we talk about the U.K. Cooperative arrangement between the United States and Great Britain in this regard, and there's some models out there that you could apply. All this is, we're not there yet, luckily, but I do think that the North Korean threat, if you extrapolate and keep going out a few decades, it's going to cause either tremendous pressure on the United States to provide this nuclear umbrella, or there's going to be some who say, well, why can't they take care of some of this deterrence themselves?
Great. Do we have another question in the back, Chris?
I'll probably break decorum by asking my fellow authors a question. It just seemed after the end of the panel, I might come to the conclusion that the primary reason the United States needs to maintain a forward presence in the Middle East and Asia is for non-proliferation reasons. All the other great power things maybe are manageable by the actors themselves, but part of the way that those actors will manage them without the United States is nuclear breakout. So in the Middle East and East Asia, do you agree with that, that the primary reason to maintain a forward presence is proliferation, not conventional or other threats?
Who would like to go first?
Well, I would just say that, I mean, I think a large percentage of in the case of Japan, and certainly with South Korea, is a non-proliferation argument. I mean, Kishi and Sato and early prime ministers in Japan talked about how Japan ought to have nuclear weapons. And some felt about it, strongly about it, because they didn't necessarily want to be so dependent on the United States. Others wanted it for future world power considerations. So today, I think, you know, obviously we didn't need as much as we had. And you can take care of the non-proliferation concern with a smaller force, and as you involve Japan more intimately and your ally in the decision making and the defense preparations, that can mitigate that to some extent. But I think it's a pretty large piece, at least with respect to Japan. And I don't know what you think, John, about Korea.
I mean, my angle is that non-proliferation gets you to the lowest common denominator, and if you're the United States, you need consistency. So it's low-hanging fruit to call it non-proliferation. But the forward presence, I think there's a lot of soul-searching going on right now. It wasn't a South Korean analyst, but a Japanese analyst, Ken Jimbo, who wrote about the provocations, especially the artillery attack in 2010, and how that was a failure of deterrence. And he was talking about the conventional aspect. So if the U.S. forward presence in the South Korean context was to deter North Korean attacks, and you just follow that definition objectively through, then you draw conclusions that there are big issues, big problems here. But I think as you move away from the lowest common denominator and look at the North Korean case, it's seen as counterproliferation. And right now the big concern is this notion, it's still the concern of the failed state scenario where North Korea with nuclear material and components that could get out into the hands of non-state actors and whatnot. But tangentially, one point that I would mention all this is that a forward presence does nothing for North Korean state trading companies operating inside of the Chinese national economy and procuring sensitive components and bringing it back to North Korea. To what extent this is happening, that I think there's more evidence that needs to be put together. But the fact that it's happening, I think there's a growing realization that it's somewhat seamless. And so that's the part where literally the capabilities that are arrayed in the region, they're not putting a dent on this and putting a lot of emphasis on the sanctions part of it, the unintentional consequences that in many respects you're empowering some of these commercial relationships.
Just with respect to the Middle East, obviously there are huge differences between East Asia and the Middle East in this regard. In terms of nuclear weapons, I don't really see a role for nuclear weapons in terms of the United States' missions in the Middle East. In terms of conventional weapons, I think that there's certainly an argument to be made that U.S. defense guarantees can play a nonproliferation role in that. Well, the argument would be that either Iran's existing nuclear program or if Iran were to develop nuclear weapons, that this could cause some sort of proliferation cascade where countries like Saudi Arabia develop nuclear weapons. The difference is that in the Middle East, you're looking at countries that, for the most part, lack the technical capabilities to develop nuclear weapons on their own. Certainly nothing like Japan and South Korea. Including the fact that one of the countries in which would be one of the prime candidates, Turkey, already has U.S. nuclear weapons stationed on its territory. The other issue is that Iran doesn't pose the same sort of conventional threat in the region that North Korea poses to South Korea. And it wouldn't require much of a greater commitment of U.S. conventional forces in order to address any potential threat. There are also a number of different reasons why you would want to maintain some sort of conventional forward deployment in the Middle East that go, as recent years have demonstrated, that go beyond non-proliferation, and I wouldn't identify that as one of the biggest considerations or even necessarily requiring a greater U.S. force commitment in the region, certainly not nuclear.
Great. Thanks to all of you for the responses. I'd like to also propose that question be tabled for our final panel. I think it'd be great to hear from Linton, from Mira, and from Ashley Tellis on that. I know Ashley specifically addresses this question in his superb overview chapter to the book, so that's a great question. Thanks, Chris. This side.
Chin Suk Lee of South Korean NBC TV. Over the years, during the Clinton administration, Bush administration, and currently Obama administration, the U.S. administration tried to sometimes impose sanctions on North Korea, sometimes try to engage itself in dialogue with North Korea, but obviously instead of denuclearizing North Korea, North Korea actually has strengthened its nuclear arsenal, it seems. So if I may throw a provocative question to you, has the U.S.-North Korea policy failed? Actually, North Korea has reached a point that NSC's deputy advisor said that North Korea crossed the threshold. So at this point, do you think would it be necessary for South Korea to go nuclear? And also, do you think, well, let me just stop there.
The first question, it's really a point of perspective. You know, if you were to poll others in the region, the Chinese or the North Koreans, depending on the particular circumstance, you're talking about a dialogue effort. Usually, there is ample evidence on their side that it was the U.S. that failed to bring it to fruition. But the bottom line is that I think from the U.S. perspective, there are a number of deals. You have the agreed framework. You have the September 2005 arrangement. They were seen as good deals, and the North Koreans didn't follow it all the way through. They reneged at some point along the way. So with that consensus view, the bar is really high now. The United States won't go back to talk for talking's sake, as much as China feels at the time is conducive for that. The idea that the dialogue will somehow lead to a breakthrough, that thesis is gone. Now it's this idea that North Korea has to show something. Either it invites International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors back to Yongbyon, or it does some version of disabling a facility and so forth. But this question of why there South Korea should go nuclear, if the view is specifically the threat from North Korea, the decision to go nuclear invites a host of other headaches and problems and dilemmas for North Korea, for South Korea. So it's not really the solution, but the beginning of other difficulties and challenges. One area that would make it particularly unfeasible in a practical sense is that sanctions would be enormously effective on South Korea. South Korea is a part of the elite $1 trillion economy club. It's an exporting nation. The degree of sensitivity to sanctions would be a test case and used and cited as an area where that is a very effective measure. In the case of North Korea, sanctions, North Korea is the most heavily sanctioned country in the world. So you have to think every time North Korea does a nuclear test or missile test and there's another round of sanctions and the various officials say this time these have teeth, then I think that implicitly means that the previous measures that were announced with these have teeth mean that it's important for political signaling and messaging, but in terms of impact, the North Korean regime is very good at evading and finding new ways to do business. But here, I go back to this notion. We look very closely and try to look closely what's happening in North Korea, but hiding out in the open are North Korean state trading companies doing business and procuring inside of China. And China, being the factory to the world, produces everything. And for foreign companies that want to produce dual-use industrial equipment for the Chinese market, makes it very, very easy for the North Korean state trading companies to procure.
We have time for one final brief question. Oh, I'm sorry. Jim, do you want to answer that?
No, that's right. We'll
take another question. This will be our last and final question down the side.
Thank you very much. My name is Tim Westmeyer. I actually work here at the Seeger Center on some of these nuclear debates in Asia projects that Mike mentioned earlier this morning. This is just continuing the conversation Mr. Park just mentioned about nuclear weapons issues, indigenous in the ROK. Do you think that debate has evolved anything further, especially with this provocations? Usually the context is provocations occur because of the lack of an indigenous nuclear capability. If we had them, then these provocations would stop. Do you think that process has gone out any sort of further in that debate? Why would those necessarily stop if they were just the similar conventional provocations? Not really sure where that debate is. Usually they use the Cold War model, but that is a very different particular situation than what occurred. Thank you.
I was at a conference in Seoul hosted by the Asan Institute, and a former prime minister of South Korea, a former foreign minister, very level-headed, very cosmopolitan individuals were saying and interpreting this growing public opinion sentiment in South Korea that South Korea should get a nuclear deterrent. They were saying that it's a part of a sentiment that it would get China's attention and that China in turn would seriously turn the screws on North Korea. That's a big gamble, and as I mentioned earlier, for South Korea to go nuclear, it invites a host of other problems. But the sentiment it's a very nuanced one. And with that, you know, when you look at South Korea going nuclear, it turns into the series of events that were likely to happen as a result of that. It feeds into the North Korean nuclear justification being
more seductive for different audiences in the region, and I would say certain groups in China as well, and it would make the nuclear problem that much more difficult. Then you would have a Korean Peninsula nuclear problem as opposed to just a North Korean nuclear problem.
Thanks, John. Jim, Robert, any parting comments? Jim.
Oh, thanks. Just on this question about South Korea, you know, I think similar debates have gone on in elite circles in Japan over the decades, and they keep looking at the costs and benefits of, you know, should we develop our own nuclear capability, and the costs always outweigh the benefits, and then it's just better to go with the U.S. Extended deterrence. And I think in Korea today, that calculation is still the same. At this point, it doesn't. The costs outweigh the benefits and should for the foreseeable future. But the key is to stay vigilant and make sure that remains the case. On just quickly on the question of, you know, has U.S. policy failed or not, certainly our policy, our collective policy in the region hasn't been successful in the sense that North Korea has the capability that it has. But neither do I think North Korea's policy goals have been achieved either, and there's been a great cost to North Korea in that regard, and growing solidarity among other players in the region. So there's still some time to play that out, I think.
Great.
I want to pick up on something that John said and connected to a broader point. John mentioned that South Korea is a lot more sensitive to coercion than North Korea. And I think this connects to the broader point that we underestimate the degree to which we can successfully coerce our friends and overestimate the degree to which we can successfully coerce our adversaries. And this this applies to the Iranian case as well, and in dealing with allies in the region like Israel, or dealing with states like Saudi Arabia that we worry might develop nuclear weapons on their own if Iran were to go nuclear. I think we overestimate the degree to which coercion would work against Iran. We often fail to consider the potential for an escalatory or paradoxical response, and we also overlook the degree to which we have substantial leverage with countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Thank you. Thank you again for the terrific questions, everyone, and invite you to join me in thanking our panelists for the terrific presentations and discussion. Thank you so much.
Transition here.